Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this new podcast venture called Between the Sheets. And as the theme which preceded me, you heard there, was of Nisley Brothers off the Between the Sheets album, one of my favorite songs of one of the best R&B groups of the 70s and 80s. And it's a great title for this show because this is a show that's going to be covering kind of a This Week in Wrestling, but with a nostalgic view to it. And my co-host for this show is David Bixenspan, who is everywhere on the internet. And me and David have talked about this for a while now, doing this type of show. And we finally decided just to get it together and run with it. And Bix, what's going on, man? How you doing?
Not much, but I can't say anything about it yet, but I'm probably going to be even more places on the internet soon, in addition to everything else. So that's all I'll say.
Well, anywhere you are, it doesn't surprise me. You could be on Japanese websites, Mexican websites. If I can see you right on Super Luchas, it wouldn't surprise me one bit. But we are joined. Our first guest on this new venture is someone who definitely is worthy of this type of show. He is a veteran of the newsletters, and currently is a contributor for the Pro Wrestling Torch website, pwtorch.com. And that is the one and the only Todd Martin. Todd, what's going on, man?
Not much. How's it going, guys?
We're grooving right here, man. Starting this new show. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be different than my other podcast, Exile on Bad Street, where we focus on one subject a shot, and we're going to be bouncing around from every subject on this show here. And basically we looked over and decided to decide we're going to go from July 20th to July 26th. We'll go from Monday to Sunday. So
Monday to Sunday in the year that we are recording it.
That's right. We're focusing on 1 year. So we're just jumping around for that year. But, because, you know, there's so much that was going on, and I hope to do this show for a long time. So we have plenty of other ways to go down in the future. But looking at the newsletters that was out at this time period, it didn't take long to figure out which one we was going to do, because we are in 1989, and this is the week of the Great American Bash pay-per-view.
The greatest wrestling pay-per-view of all time.
And there... it's very true that could be the case. As far as like being built up for your, especially your main event, it was definitely one of the best ever, one of the most legendary. It was the beginning of a upswing for a promotion that was in the doldrums for quite a while, and it was the beginning of something that, you know, we thought this could change the game. You know, that NWA, they weren't WCW yet, but, you know, Turner's NWA could be the future of wrestling. And, you know, you watch this show and you think, wow, you know, look at these great matches, and, you know, you got these motivated performers. You got Ric Flair as a fired up babyface. I mean, it was amazing stuff. And Baltimore is a great town to have a show in.
WCW show.
Yeah, they were very NWA, WCW friendly at the time period. And it's interesting that, you know, this was the year after the 88 show, which had the controversial ending with Flair and Luger, which we talked about on Exile on Bash Street, the death of Jim Crockett Promotions in depth over two shows. And, you know, the impact that came off that, and Baltimore came back strong. So credit to the promotion and the fans for being resilient enough to come back wanting more.
Now, also, but correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the pay-per-view bash, I think almost every one of them in Baltimore, I think everyone except 92 and maybe 95?
Yeah, 95 definitely wasn't.
95 was Dayton?
95 was Dayton. That's right. 88 through 91 were definitely in Baltimore.
And then 96 was in Baltimore. I forget about
I'm not sure about 97.
92, 92 I was at. That was in Savannah.
Augusta.
It was in one of those, Georgia. Yeah. Augusta, yeah. It was in East Georgia. So, yeah, that was the show where of NWA World Tag Titles Tournament. And then they didn't even do one for 93, did they?
No, they skipped 93 and 94. They came back in 95. So
that's right.
Let's see. It was 95 was Dayton, 96 Baltimore, 97 Moline, then 98 Baltimore, 99 Baltimore, 2000 Baltimore. So all except 92, 95, 98.
And it's amazing that town got...
Or 92, 95, 97, excuse me.
In that era, going around with different markets and pay-per-view, that town continued the lineage of that show even all the way to the end. So, props to Baltimore on that. But, let's talk about the show. The first match on the show was the King of the Hill Battle Royal. this is an interesting concept. It's a two-ring battle royal, old school style, from way back in the day. And basically what this match was the Danny Spivey, Sid Vicious Showcase Hour. Pretty much.
Part one of two.
Yeah, and Baltimore loved Sid Vicious. Bix, talk about young Sid Vicious and how he was, basically how he got over so quickly with the fans.
People don't remember that Sid was like this hardcore fan favorite. I mean, all of the like heel fan towns and all that, like which Baltimore was one of to a degree, were really into him. He was just, he was not a great worker by any means, but he was still green, so people forgave him. And he was just so, I think he was more physical because he didn't know as much about what he was doing, that as he became more experienced, he became more afraid to hurt people or something. So he was just very physical, incredibly charismatic, and people forget he was a really good athlete. I mean, he would do kip-ups and stuff like that, but it was mostly the presence and the way he would just squash people.
Yeah, totally. And battle royals are always hit and miss. And two-ring battle royals definitely can get a little confusing at times.
This was not bad, though.
This was not bad. Todd, what do you think about battle royals in general, and especially one like gimmick like two-ring?
I like them most. I like them better than I think most hardcore fans seem to. I feel like I'm frequently surrounded by people saying that battle royals always suck. I sort of enjoy them just in the sense that you've got a lot of people, you can have a bunch of different possibilities of who's going to win. It tends to, if you present it right, get over the guy that's winning. It's true that just a straight battle royal, as far as the work, can tend to be not particularly good because people are just sort of pairing off in the corners and trying not to do too much stuff because they don't want to hurt themselves. But I like the drama of battle royals in general.
And this one, if it revolves around booking right and getting people over like they were trying to do with the skyscrapers, because they had them split the quote unquote $50,000, and that's the job that they were trying to get out there, is get these guys over as monsters, and they were. So that was a success. And hell, Meltzer gave it 3 stars. So I mean, that's a strong star rating for a battle royal. It worked. It worked live. So that's one good thing.
And also, it was the finals of the what is it? They just had a bunch of different battle royals.
King of the Hill.
To qualify at the other best shows, right? Is that what it was?
Yeah. Basically, it's basically like a Buckhouse Stampede in a way, like the Buckhouse Stampede used to be, where you went on the Buckhouse Stampedes and then you fought in one big battle royal to determine the king of the Buckhouse Stampede. So. Yeah, they're basically ripping off Dusty's gimmick. But anyway, we're moving on to the show proper.
My impression was that really the Battle Royal gimmick was more about the tour than about the finals here. I mean, here they were doing the finals to sort of culminate the whole thing, but frequently during this time period, I mean, this was one of the last things that worked for Vern Gagne, was you do a big Battle Royal at every show in a tour territory, and on a tour that you're doing in a given territory. And like, I think that was more of the hook here, was you had a bunch of house shows, you'd have a battle royal on each house show that's King of the Ring, King of the Hill battle royal, and then this was sort of the culmination. But really the hook was each of the battle royals at each show, which made all of the shows along the line feel like there was part of something larger, something part of something more important.
And that's a great point. And yeah, it's Bunkhouse State, Stampede, like I said, used to be the same way. It always ended all the shows in all the major buildings, and it, you know, it would culminate to the end. But we all the guys in this were eventually working the other matches. So we have Brian Pillman and Wild Bill Irwin.
A couple of these guys weren't in other matches.
Oh, that's right.
Scott Hall wasn't. Ed Gilbert wasn't in another match. And I think Ranger Ross and Ron Simmons.
That's right. You're right. That's right. I forgot about Ranger Ross even in the match. Brian Pillman.
I can never forget him hitting his combat kick for some reason.
Yeah, the combat kick. Yeah. I saw a lot of Ranger Ross when I was younger, and a guy that should have been more, but he wasn't. Brian Pillman built Wild Bill Irwin, and Brian Pillman's, you know, in the middle of a push right now as the up and coming babyface, and he beats Irwin, you know, clean, as to be expected. Good little match.
Great finish.
Brian Pillman, Todd, in this era, he had only been in the business for maybe not even 2 years, basically, I would think, or close to 2 years. He was a guy that just was a freak in the ring. You know, you could just see this guy was a superstar down the line. And I always preferred him as a heel, but at this time period as a babyface, he was pretty damn good.
Yeah, I thought it was very effective as a babyface too. He was lucky in that he came along during that period when Stampede Wrestling was had just all of these great wrestlers. Benoit was working there. Owen Hart, when Owen Hart was, you know, at sort of, I guess, sort of the peak of him just producing great matches night after night. You know, Mike Shaw, when he was, you know, a pretty darn good worker. I think Shinji Hashimoto was in there. Like, there were a lot of really talented guys in Stampede. And so Pillman, for, you know, a year or two, was able to work all these great guys. And so when he came into WCW, he was ready to go because he'd gotten you know, a much higher level of experience than most guys would at that stage of their career, because Calgary just had so many great workers.
And one thing about Pillman, Bix, is that, you know, he became one of Ric Flair's guys, and Flair took him under his wing and gave him a, you know, good bit of seasoning that adds to what he had already had going for him already. Pillman could have been a great horseman down the line, which he eventually was, but I'm talking about maybe even, you know, earlier.
Before his body turned on him.
Yeah, like, when they brought the horseman back together in 93, if they would have went that route with Pillman then, although Pillman went to Austin with the Blondes. You know, if they brought Flair back as a heel, which I guess they could have never done that because he was coming back as a conquering hero. But, yeah, Flair and Pillman, I guess describe what, you know, the similarities between the two as far as in the ring, because Pillman did add a lot of that element to his style.
I mean, really, the chops are the biggest thing that stick out. I mean, I guess there were more similarities as a heel, like, kind of, because you could tell he patterned some of his heel style after Flair. You could tell,
yeah,
like, with totally. The way he would time, like, the begging off and stuff like that.
And we know, and it's a running joke that the only guy to be trained by Ric Flair was Stan Lane, but which Big Stan Lane will let you know that early and often. But yeah, Pillman was one of Flair's guys, and he was protecting him because Flair was just now, you know, getting the book or getting more power in the promotion. So this is a good way to spotlight him out. And speaking of spotlight, the next match was the Skyscrapers against the Dynamic Dudes.
If you thought Sid was over in the Battle Royal,
he was mega over here. And the thing about the Dudes is, I mean, Johnny Ace and Shane Douglas, good talent at the time period. Johnny Ace was, you know, green, but still, you know, he had the look and he could do some things. But the gimmick was definitely not for the fans that the NWA had at the time, I would say. And it wasn't just Baltimore, and I didn't get behind them. It was a lot of other towns, too.
Philly,
all the Northeast, Chicago, going to the Midwest. I know even some of the Atlanta, you know, the shows in Atlanta, they were getting booed out of the building. So it didn't really work there. It probably would have worked better with Vince. But, man, Sid Vicious, like we talked about him earlier, was just a complete monster. But Dan Spivey. Dan Spivey's a guy who really got good later on, but Bix, talk about Dan Spivey and how he the more he worked Japan, the better he got.
Yeah, he's a really underrated guy. I mean, he's already really good at this point. He just doesn't get to show it much in WCW, and really didn't in general as much as he did in Japan. But like, it was, what was it, like a month and a half before this that he had the match in All Japan with Sting?
Yes.
That's a tremendous match. If for people who've never seen it, I mean, that is, like, Sting in Japan is always really fun, but this is like the beginning of Sting in Japan, and just Spivey knows exactly what to do with him to have the right match for, like, for their place on the card, for Sting's first tour, just everything, and it's just all action, a lot of fun. I mean, big bumper for his size, Spivey, which I'm sure did not help with his knees and everything, but just really, really talented. I mean, he had a short peak, though. I mean, because he was pretty old already. I mean, he started wrestling at, what, 35?
Yeah, because he played at University of Georgia and like 15 years before this show. I mean, he was in the 73, 74 at University of Georgia playing football.
Yeah, and he had started wrestling in 84, 85.
84, yeah.
Didn't really do much for the first few years, even though he, you know, he had the WWF run. And I'm trying to think. Now, when did he first go to Japan, though?
87, 80. No, he went maybe 86, but he was going over there. But no, his first big run was around this time period, yeah. Going 89. So, yeah, I mean, he definitely underrated guy, and got better. We saw him get better in, you know, later on. WCW, especially the Luger match at Wrestle War 91.
Yes, and this match also I love, though, has the constant We Want Sid chance.
Yes.
Where Spivey works most of the match, gets We Want Sid chance, tags Sid in, gets a big pop, Sid does something, tags back out, We Want Sid, rinse, repeat.
Yeah, and then Spivey messed up the finish, too, which didn't help his call. And nearly killed Johnny Ace. Dynamic Dudes, Todd, Shane Douglas, he was an effective babyface worker, but he had the face that you wanted to punch, and he was way better as a heel. The Shane Douglas, you know, babyface, do you think it ever worked, or was he just a heel at all times?
I don't know. I mean, I thought he was fairly effective when he was teaming with Ricky Steamboat in WCW. I think that it was a gimmick as much as anything that was making the dudes have such trouble. I mean, just even calling them the Dynamic Dudes, like, you just sound ridiculous saying the Dynamic Dudes. I mean, not to mention, you know, the skateboards, the colors. I mean, the whole thing was just shit. I think that was the biggest issue there. Shane didn't work as a babyface a lot, and I think he was more of a natural heel. But I don't know. I don't necessarily think that he was unsuited or unable to play babyface so much as this run was just a terrible gimmick.
The one thing that we got to mention, you know, this is 1989, and that stuff was pretty hot then, as far as like the colors, like you talked about, and like that California culture. But yeah, it came off as totally forced, and just it didn't work. It really didn't work. Unless it probably would have worked better with Vince, but. And the territory where, you know, Jim Ross has proclaimed it's the NWA, we wrestle, we're serious wrestling, and with all the other type of acts, yeah, it just didn't work. So now we move to the match of the night, the Tuxedo Street Fight between Jim Cornette and Paulie Dangerously. This is one of those matches where it was what it was. I mean, considering who you had in the match.
Honestly, I think it's a really good match.
It worked in a way. It was good comedy. And it gave you the good payoff. But Jim Cornette, Paul E. Few, Todd, these two guys were made for each other. I mean, you can definitely tell that Paul was he watched a lot of Cornette over the years and patterned a lot of his style to him. And we all know what happened later on down the line, you know, with him personally. But talk about the dynamic of this feud.
I thought the match worked, too. I thought it was sort of a fun little thing. Jim Cornette and Paul Heyman work with most anyone. I mean, they're just such talented guys on the microphone. I mean, two of the most talented ever that, you know, you can put them in there with, you know, really bad guys and they can get it over just on the way that they talk. So when you put two guys like that that can both talk so well against each other, you know, it's obviously going to work because they're both so good. And I think they both sort of wanted to one up each other, and they both have a real gift for being very quick on their feet. I think Cornette even more so than Paul Heyman. And so when you sort of had them battling with each other, and the style of promos back then was more extemporaneous. So it wasn't as much, you know, planning stuff out in advance. So it was very much sort of thinking on your feet and trying to outsmart the other guy and get the better lines in, which, you know, makes for very, very entertaining television. And there's such a contrast between, you know, the personalities with, you know, the fast talking New Yorker and the, you know, the Southerner with the tennis racket. So yeah, I thought that the stuff that they did together was, you know, universally pretty darn good.
Yeah. And Bix, Cornette had been gone for a while. You know, a lot of people don't remember this, but the Midnight Express, with the contract ran out, and they did a little independent tour for a little bit. And, came back, and Cornette was right back in with Paul. Even though there was no real feud going on with the Midnight Express or the Samoa SWAT team at the time, but talk about that the independent tour deal and the, you know, the kind of the strangeness of it.
I think they only ended up working like what, two matches? I think it was like one with Bad Company in Pennsylvania, and then like a couple one or two matches in Continental, something like that.
I think there were more than that in Continental, though, if I'm not mistaken.
Because I don't think I have the scrapbook anymore, but it was not much. It was because Dundee was booking Continental.
Yeah.
And so, which I didn't even remember that he was booking it then until I read that. But so they did it as a favor for him there. And they worked for an indie in Pennsylvania against Bad Company with Mark Curtis, Brian Hildebrand as their manager, which is a really cool match that I wish was on videotape somewhere. I'm very unusual for the time, especially because by the time that they ended up leaving, they knew they were going to come back. Originally, they were just going to leave. But then it was, I think it was because George Scott got fired, right?
Yeah.
That they decided, okay, we'll just come back after we know we're going to be fresh on TV again. And they came back as the mystery team in the tag title tournament.
Yeah, and that was a whole weird deal that, you know, they let to begin with. You know, they were World Tag Team Champions and, of course, lost those titles.
Although Cornette did cut a promo on TV to explain it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, which I haven't seen in years, so I can't remember exactly what all he said. But, yeah, I mean, and they needed a break, I guess, you know, and sometimes that works out for the best, you know, to give some, you know, guys a chance to get refreshed. And, they came back in, they were real hot when they came in as the mystery team in the tournament. But then, you know, of course, it wasn't too long down the line before they're back heels again. And, you know, then we had the Cornette-Jim Herb battles, which we'll cover that in other shows. But move on to the next match. Rick and Scott Steiner in a Texas Tornado match against the Varsity Club, Mike Rotundo and Kevin Sullivan. Scott Steiner is, you know, fairly new in WCW at this time period. And, the team with Rick is really starting to get going. This match went 5 minutes long.
4 minutes and 22 seconds.
Yeah. So we had that going on. And plus, this was a backdrop for the angle with Kevin Sullivan and Mike Rotundo, where they shoved each other and Rotundo walked out on him. But next, talk about Scott Steiner in 1989. You know, we talk about Sid, you know, and showing the potential he had. Scott Steiner looked like he was going to be, you know, future world champion in 1989.
Scott Steiner, like, because I was lucky enough to go to school at a school where other kids actually watched WCW. So, like, Scott Steiner was basically God at this point. Maybe not for another month or two, but he, you know what I mean. Like, especially, like, at summer camp and stuff, like, just Scott Steiner was just the man. I mean, the Frankensteiner, he had this amazing presence. He was so explosive in there. I mean, he was unlike anyone else. And I mean, the tag team role with his brother was more experienced and all that was perfect at that time. And they could just throw. And they weren't really the Steiner brothers as we know them yet, though.
No, because they were. Yeah, they weren't wearing any type of matching gear. Scott was still wearing short tights, and Rick was still in his Michigan gear, and you still had Missy Hyatt was their manager, which we had the great line from Jim Ross. Look at that pair. And there's the Steiners. And then this was also the time period where Rick starting his angle up with Robin Green, which Robin Green was a geeky girl in the stands, wearing glasses, a baseball hat, you know, a lot of clothes, and became Rick Steiner's girlfriend, eventually leading to a skit where Rick Steiner, he was asking Jim Ross for dating advice, and they went and met Robin Green in a hotel room. It opened the door and ended up being Woman. And the Rick Steiner, Jim Ross facial expressions on that skit are just phenomenal when they open the door up. But, and of course, we all know what happened later on. But yeah, Rick Steiner was still very over to babyface at this time period. And like I said, Scott was a great addition to what he had going on. But the Varsity Club, Todd, we talked about this on the 1988 Jeff Crockett show. Varsity Club is severely underrated in my opinion as a unit. It was the best Mike Rotunda probably ever was in his career. What did you think of the gimmick and how it actually did way better than probably what they thought it was going to do in the first place?
To be honest, I wasn't a big fan of the act. I thought it was just sort of a weird pairing. Kevin Sullivan was a guy that through much of his career played this sort of satanic, role. And here he's managing two guys that are sort of playing up being, college lettermen like a decade earlier. I don't know. It never really clicked for me as an act.
Well, the problem was Rotunda, that it was too subtle. I mean, Sullivan actually had an idea in mind with that he was corrupting these clean-cut college-educated athletes, but it was never more than subtext.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah. The only time they ever did anything like Satanic Sullivan was the whole deal with Precious.
Right.
I mean, other than that, Bix is totally right. It was way too subtle for what they were going for. It was too inside baseball, I guess you could say. You know, we're supposed to get this, but you got to read between the lines. And this is 1988, 89, and there weren't a whole hell of a lot of smart wrestling fans back then. I mean, smart to the, newsletters or, inside, what's going on backstage. So, yeah, I guess you could, on the surface, it could have been, something that it wasn't what it should have been. But they really had a lot of good stuff going on for them. I will say that, It definitely, like I said, Mike Rotunda was at his peak here as a character and probably as a wrestler. So, yeah, I mean, and this was a flat way to end it. And boy, Mike Rotunda went downhill after this happened. He soon becoming Captain Mike and, eventually Michael Wall Street and then going to the FSIRS where he had probably had his best success. So that's, one thing. Next match. Sting and the Great Muta for the NWA World Television title.
This is the first match that really has a backstage story to it, too.
Yeah, what a match this was. And it didn't even go 10 minutes. This is Sting, at his peak as a worker, before the injury. And Muta, who is just phenomenal. And Muta was a guy. This is a feud that it worked in a lot of ways because those two guys were made for each other. But Muta was really hot as a baby face in a lot of markets. And it kind of hurt Sting sometimes that Muta was getting more of a baby face reaction than he was. But Vix, talk about the match. Talk about the finish and the story that was involved.
I just like to use Gary Hart's description for it, that it's like two superheroes flying around. That you have these two, big actual heavyweight size guys doing this crazy all-action, high-flying match, and they have the face paint, and it's colorful and everything. Just they matched up with each other as perfectly as they possibly could, from the in-ring style to their look, everything. And they had other good matches, but I feel like this is the best they had, at least to the televised matches. And the finish, which was not the original scheduled finish, if I remember correctly, was Muda blows the red mist, Sting ducks, it hits Tommy Young, another referee comes in, they do, I forget exactly which variation of a double pin suplex finish, but Muda...
Backdrop suplex.
No, but I meant in terms of whose shoulder was up versus down versus whatever. But,
both of them was up.
Oh, it was both up. Okay. I hate that version of it because, like, if they're both up the whole time, like, for a long time, why does...
Why count?
Know? Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous, and...
But Muda was announced the winner.
Yeah, and eventually, of course, they vacated the title.
Oh, no, Sting was announced the winner. I'm wrong. No, Sting was announced the winner, but Muda left with the belt.
And then they eventually vacated the title and decided later on television. But to me, Todd, this was a situation where, yeah, it was a great feud. And, it was two guys that were coming up at the right time. But that was the problem. You do a match like this and you book yourself into a situation where you don't really need a job, either one of these guys. So that's why they went with a non-finish. But I get frustrated when they do feuds like this. You know, when you got two guys that don't need to lose. What is your opinion on that type of scenario?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I think it depends on the culture of the promotion at the time. With like WWE today, there's a tendency that the guys on the mid card just sort of get stuck there for long periods of time. So it becomes more imperative to have guys not lose as much, and they lose a lot, so they don't really elevate. But I feel like if you've got a hot promotion, it's something that can work really well, and you can set up future things. I think, you know, a decade later, they had The Rock and Triple H feuding, and it was sort of a similar deal where you've got two guys that are rising up the card. Both of them are likely to be headlining in the future, but although obviously they didn't end up having that much for Muda in NWA, although that was sort of, for reasons that were difficult to forecast at this point in time. But you've got these guys that are both sort of rising to the top, and here they are meeting before they get to the top. And I think there's sort of drama in that. I think it adds stakes as you're sort of waiting to see, well, which one of these guys is going to sort of get the edge. And as opposed to it being a hindrance, I think if you've got a well-booked promotion, it can be a benefit as far as setting up feuds down the road. You know, if at this point in time, let's say Muda gets the better of Sting, okay? You know, Muda beats Sting, Muda retains the TV title. It slows Sting a little bit, but let's say a year and a half later, Sting's moved to the top at that point. You can feud Sting and Muda, and you can play off that old story. You know, now Sting's beaten Flair for the title. Sting's the guy that's riding tall. But hey, here's this... who's this guy from the past that beat him when they were both rising up there. I think it's sort of it's a natural story. It's a story you see more in Japan than in the U.S. Historically, but I think it's something that can work really well. So I think you can use it to your advantage, but you've got to be smart about what you're doing.
And, you know, and that's one thing. Sting and Moon were always tied to the hip. You know, they were still feuding in 2000. So, I mean, they definitely would play off each other. And you're totally right. You know, if you're a good enough booker, you can make it work. There's no doubt about it. And that's, you know, one of the big problems of modern WWE these days is they got all these guys that are just constantly losing to each other, even Steven booking, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, it's a tough way to go. But if you're good enough and smart enough, you can make it work. And then eventually they would, you know, get Flair and Funk involved in the feud. And, you know, it went on from there.
I eventually mean the end of the show.
Yeah, we're about to get to it. But yeah, I mean, it was a good way to start off, I guess, because this was their first big match, and you kind of want to do a non-finish.
It was a long 2 hours.
Yeah, you kind of want to have a nice non-finish there to start off the feud. But anyway, we go to the next match.
Well, we didn't talk about the backstage story beside this.
All right, go ahead. Go ahead.
So, Eddie Gilbert and Sting had reunited on this.
Oh
TV.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Yeah, I was about to bring that up later, but go ahead.
Because they had reunited basically as babyfaces because they both had issues with Muda at the same time. Eddie was the one feuding with Muda on the house show so they could kind of preserve the Sting match for the pay-per-view. And they had kind of telegraphed that Eddie was going to turn on Sting at the pay-per-view. And
on the Danger Zone on the night before on World Championship Wrestling where Paul brought up the old photo of the first family from UWF, Sting, Rick Steiner, Eddie, and Missy, and was all in Sting's face while Eddie was standing there about how Eddie's going to throw fire in Muta's face and he's going to screw Sting out of the title and all this other stuff. Eddie's always looking out for Eddie. And then Sting was like, no, Eddie's my friend, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, that's what you were getting at, right?
Right, and then they thought too many people had figured it out, even though it's wrestling, you kind of sort of want people to figure it out, but not exactly, and they decided to nix it, and Eddie never ended up turning back heel, and that was the beginning of the end of it.
Killed Eddie dead in the water, too.
Yeah.
Because his run in the promotion after that was like nothing. I mean, he was basically a jobber to the stars in a lot of ways, which was sad. Because Eddie Gilbert as a heel was so damn good, but he didn't get the spotlighted on that national stage. Only time he ever did was in the UWF era, and when they were working with Crocker, he was with Terry Taylor. But Eddie Gilbert, as a heel on television, I don't know. I guess he would have feuded with Sting too, or whatever. That could have been really strong stuff. So it's a shame we never got that. And I think a lot of that had to do with Flair too, because Flair was not the biggest Eddie Gilbert fan. We would learn down the line. I mean, he actually actively tried to bury Eddie Gilbert in a lot of ways. So, which do we even know what the deal is with that?
I thought it was the promos that Gilbert cut in 87 about the EWF that Flair thought was shoot promos, and that was the
deal. That was that run, but darn, Flair was still holding the grudge.
There was the story that when Eddie was put on the booking committee that at WrestleWar, because it's like him and Jim Ross booking, Michael Hayes and Jim Ross as the announcing team are about to start on the main TV show, that Gilbert, when he was sitting with some of the fans, because you had your NWA pay-per-view deadheads back then of, like, the newsletter fans who went to every show. Like, you had Meltzer, John McAdam, guys like that. And I think it was
Dr.
around...
Lucha.
Yeah, and I think it was around then that Eddie said something like, the UWF rises again at WrestleWar.
Oh. I remember hearing that line. Yeah, that... And that's pretty petty on Flair, though, but, it's wrestling. Wrestling and pettiness go together hand in hand, right, Todd?
Eddie Gilbert caused a lot of problems for himself over the years.
I mean, oh, God.
I never knew the guy, but, I mean, and I'm not sticking up for Flair because I don't know what the relationship was there, but, I mean, Eddie Gilbert burned so many bridges that I'm reluctant to give anyone too much blame for having issues with Eddie Gilbert behind the scenes, because there's just an incredible pattern there for a guy that was so talented.
This was really the beginning of that, though. I mean, he really did not have that bad rep up to this point.
It got worse, but I mean, he was the guy that bounced around more than he probably should have, given what a mind he had for the business, not to mention his talents in front of the camera.
Yeah.
The one thing he did have fixed is he had the whole deal with David Woods. And that was a pretty publicized situation where he just let David Woods high and dry.
But where a lot of people sided with him.
Yeah, a lot of people sided with Eddie in that deal. But, it was what it was. All right, next match. United States Heavyweight title. Lex Luger against Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Lex Luger had just turned heel at the Clash of the Champions the month earlier. And he is phenomenal at this point of his career. He's found himself as a heel. He's basically being Lex Luger, on television. And, the real Lex Luger in a lot of ways. Steamboat, just coming off the Flair deal, phased down a little bit to the U.S. title hunt. But a great guy for Luger to feud with to get over. The match went a little over 10 minutes, had a DQ finish, but, and even though the match was originally supposed to be a no DQ match, but, had a DQ finish.
This is one of the greatest DQ finishes you'll ever see, though.
Yeah. The fans were really into the match. It played off the angle at the Clash with the steel chair. So that was a great way of going out with that. But, and Luger to his credit, the fans were really behind Luger to start off with, because Steamboat's one of those guys that's going to get booed in towns like Baltimore in a lot of ways. But Luger was so awesome as a heel that he turned the crowd. And
that promo, and like, before the match is so good.
And there were chants, I'm quoting here, chants of steroid faggot, quote unquote, by the end of the match from some of the ringside fans. So he definitely got himself over in a big way. But man, yeah, even though it was a 10-minute match, they did a lot of good stuff here. Todd, Lex Luger is as a heel character. We know we talked about Shane Douglas earlier. He's perfect as a heel.
Yeah, I mean this was right in the middle of the best run of his career. I mean, he was having really good matches by and large. I mean, granted, you know, over a few year period when you're working with Flair and Steamboat, that'll certainly help you. But he was having good matches. He showed a lot of fire. He was over with the crowd. I mean, this was a period where a lot of people were really thinking Luger was going to be it in the business for the next decade. Obviously, it didn't end up working out, but I mean, if you go back and watch this tape, and I mean, this is one of my childhood favorites. This is one I'd very frequently rent from Blockbuster. I mean, this was, mm-hmm. you know, this is a period where Luger seemed like a very big deal on this show in particular.
And you look at Baltimore, I mean, it was the year earlier when he got screwed out of the title with Flair, and we come back and it's, you know, a totally different deal, where Luger is basically screwing Steamboat because he refused to have that no DQ match. And Steamboat eventually agreed to have the regular match with Gary Juster. So Luger made Steamboat look like a fool in a lot of ways. Yeah. But that's his job, because he's a heel.
Bob Caudle is great here too, by the way.
Bob Caudle was awesome on commentary on this as well. You're right. But Steamboat, this was supposed to be the beginning of a I wouldn't say a long feud, but it was supposed to carry over definitely from August to September. But Steamboat's contract runs out on July 30th. So, and they really aren't making the best effort to re-sign into a contract. And they actually want him to work the dates in August and September, but on guaranteed nightly money. So what do you think about that situation? Do you think that they should have made a better play to keep Ricky, you know, in the fold?
I don't know. I actually, when I did the Flair Steamboat article for Fighting Spirit last year, I asked him about this. He kind of looked back on it and was like, I probably should have just signed with them. I don't know why I didn't. He basically characterized it as him being stupid.
Well, you know what Ric Flair will say? He'll blame his wife. You know, Rick, you know, on the Steamboat podcast, Rick, that they did, Rick definitely, you know, had it out there that Bonnie was one of the, you know, the forces behind Ricky's inactivity a lot of his career. So that's probably part of it. And Ricky was a dude and they loved to stay close to home.
Although to be fair, the story of the moral of Ric Flair's podcast, unfortunately, is you can't trust women. So I don't know. I don't know how much Bonnie in particular would play a role there.
Well, we know that Ricky got a divorce from her eventually, so I guess, you know, there were some issues, you know, down the line. But yeah, I mean, Steamboat definitely should sign. And eventually, you know, the guy they signed to replace him was Tom Zink, and you know. And Z-Man had a decent run. He was there for quite a while, but Tom Zink's no Ricky Steamboat.
That's there for almost 5 years.
I know.
I don't think people realize that.
You know, and then eventually Ricky would come back a year later and work for George Scott and his independent promotion, and then, you know, bounced around and WWF and back to, you know, WCW later on. But yeah, Ricky was still really greatest performer, which, you know, that's no shock there. And it would have definitely been fun to see him and Luger progress, because basically what it did was, is he left and basically Luger had to, you know, work with Tommy Rich. And I love Wildfire Tommy Rich, but that's a definite big difference.
And those were good matches too, though.
Good matches, but that's a big difference.
Oh, and of course, the legend with this match is that the match they had the night before in Philly, Luger and Steamboat, was even better.
Yeah, which, you know, I was going to talk about that in a minute, but after we did this show. But yeah,
well,
it was a longer match too, so that also worked out, I guess, in his favor. All right, next match, and what a match this is. We have a 10-man tag match of the Road Warriors, the Midnight Express, and Dr. Death Steve Williams against the Fabulous Freebirds, Garvin, Gordy, and Hayes, and the Samoan SWAT team, Fatu and Samu. 22-minute match.
War Games, the match beyond.
War Games, the match beyond. I love this match. I thought it was really strong. Next, talk about, you know, them using War Games after Dusty's been fired. You know, they kept the gimmick going, even though this was the last one until 91. But talk about this match and how it worked.
This is an excellent War Games. It's not really in the conversation that much, because I guess it's not as good as, you know, the first one. It's not as good as 91 or 92, and maybe not as heated in some ways, or it doesn't have the great promo leading up to it that 94 did. But it's really good. I mean, you got the Road Warriors are, in some ways, maybe better workers than they were before. You got the Midnight Express, who are incredible babyfaces at this point. You've got Doc, who works amazingly well with Gordy all the time and has a famous spot with Doc military pressing Gordy into the top of the cage 10 times.
8 times!
Was it 8 or was it 10? I thought it was 10.
8 in a row.
Samoan SWAT team are really good, although they regressed a little bit from when they were in Dallas. And Hayes is tremendous at ringside throughout the whole match with Paulie. That Hayes, of course, is the, well, I guess, of course, it's going to be Hayes or Garvin in last because it's War Games and it's who, you know, whichever of the more chicken shit type heels you want to have go in last. And throughout, Hayes keeps asking Paul, well, who's going in next? And then he says, whoever else. And he's like, okay, good. And then finally, it's like, okay, Paul, who's going in next? You're the only one left. Oh, crap.
Yeah, and that made it work, because you look at, you know, who started the match with Jimmy Garvin, and Jimmy Garvin's no Arn Anderson. You know, War Games, you know, before basically was, you know, Arn Anderson and Dusty Rhodes were the guys that started the match more often than not. And this one, you had Bobby Eaton and Jimmy Garvin started off. So, you know, it's a different style. But, yeah, in fact, there was a lot of really good stuff here. Jim Ross was really strong on commentary for this one as well. Lots of great bumps. Hayes hitting 4 DDTs
and coming in. Strutting.
And then strutting. And, yeah, it was quite a spectacle. Todd, War Games is a gimmick. It really worked in this time period. Do you think that WWE should bring it back?
I'm not one of the people that's sort of gung-ho about bringing it back, because I don't know. It just doesn't have the same nostalgia pull for me that I think it does with a lot of people. With that said, they run so many shows, and it's sort of a distinct gimmick that I think would fit into certain feuds that I certainly would bring it back if it were my call when I had the right feud, given they haven't done it for such a long period of time. But it's not – I feel like there are a lot of people that sort of clamor for it, and I'm not part of that contingent. But I do think it could be used, and there's no good reason not to.
And, you know, with Big Salt by the Road Warriors, this was their perfect style of match right here. Anytime the Road Warriors were in War Games, they were pretty damn awesome. So this definitely worked for them. Hawk, the dive he went across the ring, and nobody was prepared for it.
The next ring with the double clothesline.
Yeah, just wild stuff, man. And yeah, it was a strong match and
great finish.
Great finish, yeah. With the
Hangman's new neck breaker.
The Hangman, then the heels recover and start beating the crap out of Animal until, you know, the faces made the save. So, yeah, very strong match and a good buffer between the Luger Steamboat match and to the main event, which is, of course, the legendary match between Nature Boy Ric Flair and Terry Funk for the War Heavyweight title. Flair's first match back since Wrestle War. in May against Steamboat, where, you know, everybody knows what happened there with the famous angle with LeFunk, Paul driving into the table. Flair was phenomenal in this match. Just fantastic. And it's funny that, you know, the year before, we had this whole big deal about the blood finish with Lex Luger, you know, where he had that little trickle of blood and had to stop the match. Yet Flair is, you know, got double juice. Flair's just covered in blood and nothing's being said. You know, the commission's like, you know, let it go. And what the thing is suppose, you know, they challenged the commission before the show. They said, listen, you know, we want to have blood on this show, and they won the battle. So props to them for doing that. But Biggs, talk about the Flair Funk feud, the lead in going into this. Terry Funk's awesomeness, Flair's awesomeness. Just give a brief overview of what we had.
So Funk had not been on national television since 86, I guess.
Yes.
When he blew out his knee in WWF?
Yes.
Okay.
Unless you count like maybe some TV shows, non-wrestling.
Right. But he had basically ceased to be a national pro wrestling figure.
Yes.
And one of the things people forget about the angle that set this all up at WrestleWar, Roadhouse either had just come out or was about to come out.
It came out in June.
Okay, so Roadhouse is like a couple weeks away from coming out when WrestleWar happens. So you're just not going to think that Funk being there does not signify an angle to anyone. You have no reason to think that.
Well, they just had him in New Orleans. Remember,
too,
he did the color commentary with Ross on the Flair Steamboat match there.
That too.
Yeah, they've run him in a number of times over that period. So yeah, they've done a good job of masking it.
And he's just, you know, all the interviews with the bring out Rick, R-I-C-K, Rick Flair, F-L-A-R-E, painting the yellow streak down his back. All the great squash matches where it was just him against all the best job guys or pseudo job guys they could find. Eddie Guerrero coming in for one shot, Brad Armstrong, Davey Rich. I think Johnny Rich too.
Yeah.
That Negro match, if anyone's never seen it, is really good. Of course, he didn't get hired because he was too small. And then the promo after the Eddie Guerrero match is tremendous, where, you know, the whole thing where it's, my father had a jackass. I loved that jackass. And he killed that jackass. And Ric Flair, you are a jackass. Or whatever it was. It was something like that.
Awesome.
That's a pretty darn good Terry Funk impression.
Yeah, and you know, Terry Funk was an out of control guy, and it was something that, you know, you really haven't seen in wrestling, really. And I don't know. I guess it's Brody in a lot of ways, as far as a guy that's just going. Although Dick Murdoch was doing some of that stuff in early 1988, but not nearly on the level as Terry Funk was. I mean, this was just, you know. He come off as somebody that's literally insane, you know, the way he was acting. And Todd, regarding the match itself, for two guys who really didn't work together that much, you know, before, you know, Flair and Funk, Flair and Terry, I think I could count maybe five or six times they worked against each other when Flair was world champion.
And not for years before this, too.
Yeah, awesome chemistry. I mean, this was a fantastic match. And like I said, you watched this tape a lot over the years. What were your impressions of the match and how they worked together?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a great match, obviously. And I think part of what made it so fun was it was such a contrast to what had come before. You know, we'd had this long feud with Flair and Steamboat where it was very technically oriented. You had a lot of longer matches that were very, you know, very much in the ring and wrestling. And then you bring in Terry Funk, and all of a sudden it's just these wild brawls and just a complete contrast from what had come before, which I think made it all the more exciting, particularly given that sort of more up my alley as far as sort of my own you know, my own personal taste. So yeah, I mean, this thing clicked great, and I mean, it's part of why the show's very fondly remembered by a lot of people.
And then we have, you know, the added elements to the feud. You know, Gary Hart comes with Terry Funk to ringside, and then we have the angle afterwards. But first, I want to touch on the finish real quick, and the touches they gave to the past and the finish was really good because, you know, Flair beat Funk with the inside cradle, right?
Off the spinning toe hold.
Yep. Off the spinning toe hold. Okay. That's the same sequence that Funk used on Jack Briscoe, but in a figure four to win the title from Jack. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 14 years earlier. So I like that little nod to the past. And, of course, after the match, Muda comes out, spits the green mist in Flair's face. Funk and Muda start beating the shit out of Sting. I mean, Sting, Flair. And then Sting comes out for a wild brawl. I mean, just crazy brawl.
This goes like another 10 minutes, too.
Yeah. It was longer than most of the matches on this show.
Although, one thing I have to comment on, if you're like me, or at least Todd for a long time, this might have been the only version of the show you might have seen was the home video version, which cuts almost the entire ball out. And
yes.
Flair's promo where he's covered in blood and green mist, which
They aired on television,
but
a lot.
But still, if you're, you know, it was the easiest. Now it's on WWE Network, thankfully. But I mean, for years, if you wanted to watch, the easiest way to find that show And even though most of the edits on that tape were good, you know, Turner was not always good at how they edited down the shows, but they just edited the prelim matches when they needed to, and then all the big matches were unedited, but then they cut that. So,
yeah, it was a fantastic brawl, though. Todd, Flair and Sting as a combination, it really worked here, I thought, you know, in this era. And I think they ended it way too soon the next year. But talk about the dynamic there between those two and how it worked so well.
Did you mean Flair and Sting? Or did you mean someone else?
No, Flair and Sting is a partnership.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear since we, you know, this is sort of, yeah. I mean, I I liked it, but I think that there was a bit of a problem in it, in that I always identified more with Flair than Sting. And you know, Sting was the rising babyface, and I think people got behind Sting sort of rising up to challenge Flair. But the one issue with the Flair and Sting partnership was it felt like Flair was constantly outsmarting Sting, you know, over a period of years, which was satisfying for me as someone that kind of preferred Flair. But I think it did limit Sting a little bit. That you know, whenever they teamed up, it invariably ended with Flair turning on Sting and Sting not seeing it coming. And I think that Sting being sort of a dupe for Flair, I think at times hindered him. But yeah, I mean, it was a relationship that, you know, is one of the more important ones as far as getting Sting to that, you know, upper echelon level. And, you know, it was the feud from, you know, the first Clash of the Champions through the Great American Bash 1990 that took Sting from a guy that was, you know, a UWF castoff to a guy, well, castoff's probably the wrong word, but, you know, sort of an afterthought in the UWF purchase to, you know, WCW's, you know, prized young babyface.
And yeah, you had the dynamic where Flair is, you know, nature boy Ric Flair, always in suits and all this other stuff. And Sting's out there face painted, Muscle Beach type, you know, the Venice Beach gear, you know, tank tops and, you know, the baggy pants, stuff like that. It was a different deal, you know, just like, you know, Perfect Strangers in a lot of ways. But Flair was so hot as a babyface here that, you know, it was only natural that they would hook up and
align. So wait, does align. That make Sting Balky?
Maybe, I guess you could say. But yeah, I mean, the promo afterwards, Flair is just a complete madman. Shaking hands with Sting, which was, you know, a big deal. Just fantastic stuff. And what was funny was on the TV leading up to this show, Jim Ross made it a point to mention that there would be no highlights of these matches shown on television. Well, I think for the next 3 weeks, they were showing highlights of the matches from the show. You know, so that was pretty hilarious. A couple other things from this show that I, you know, did get mentioned was Jason Hervey made an appearance on this show as the ring announcer for the Dynamic Dudes, which Jason Hervey and WCW, NWA was a marriage that went for many years. Hervey was
both
a big wrestling
fan. WCW's existence on and off.
Yeah, Hervey was, you know, married to they weren't married. He wasn't married to Misty Hyatt. No. They were going together at one point.
He had the Terry Funk connection.
The Terry Funk connection. You know, eventually he was. Was he part of the booking team at one point too?
Towards the end, maybe. He was, yes, at least was had some sort of production role, I think, at some point.
And then we had all the injuries on this show. I mean, so many guys. Terry Funk had a fractured sacrum on his lower back. Johnny Ace had a broken cheekbone. Sid Vicious had back injury. Jim Cornette had knee issues, which plagued him for many years. Yeah, I mean, it was a show where guys were just banged up, but man, they were kicking ass. But the night before, in Philly, they had they normally did Philadelphia and Baltimore and back to back nights. Which makes a lot of sense because, you know, it's not that far away from each other. But, you know, the biggest talk about Luger and Steamboat had a match on the Philly show that, guys like Dave Meltzer said that was way better than the Baltimore show. It went a little bit longer, and they did the same type of finish. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a shame. You know, we got some of these Philly shows on tape, right, from that era, but this one wasn't – this never made it, did it? Okay, just go over the show real quick. You know, Al Green, yep, B. Al Green from later on in WCW, you know, towards the end with Brian Knobs. And Ron Simmons beat Scott Hall and Joey Maggs. What a interesting matchup that is. Norman, the Lunatic, who Todd talked about earlier, is Mike Shaw, beat Ranger Ross, who we talked about earlier as well. Norman's a guy. Was he even? I can't remember. He wasn't on the Bash, was he? Was he not in the Battle Royal?
No.
Norman was a hot character on television this time, and just wasn't even on the show. So that was interesting. Skyscrapers against Johnny and Davey Rich. Of course, that was death. The Dynamic Dudes beating the New Zealand Militia. Mike Rotunda and Scott Steiner in a suplex match.
That's which, interesting.
Yeah. Kevin Sullivan beat Rick Steiner. Coal Miner's Glove match. Muta beat Eddie Gilbert. Where Gary Hart got the glove and not that Eddie Gilbert. So there's your Muta Gilbert house show feud. And the reason why they were mainly doing Muta and Gilbert house show feud is because Sting and Terry Funk were the house show feud.
Right.
So, and they had a no DQ match where Sting beat Terry Funk by pinning Bill Irwin. And then we had a Bad Street match with the Road Warriors, Midnights, and Dr. Death against the Freebirds and Samoan SWAT team. So,
wasn't this like the peak of Prima Donna Sting?
Yes. Yeah, totally. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, Sting was, he was peaking at every way at this time period. I thought so. He should have been a big star, but you know, that's a whole nother story. But then the next night after the Bash was, on Entertainment Tonight, they did a feature on the wrestling war between the NWA and WWF. Have either one of you ever seen this?
I don't think so.
No, I haven't.
Is it on YouTube or anything?
I don't think it is. I remember watching it live because Entertainment Tonight, my parents will watch it, and they still do, amazingly. And it would always come on after the local news. And I remember that being on. Entertainment Tonight has a history with wrestling going way back. You know, they covered the Georgia Championship Wrestling popular in 1982, which was around the time period where Morocco and Piper turned babyface and all that stuff, saving Gordon Soley. So their history of wrestling goes way back. But basically what this piece was it made NWA look like the USFL. For those of you that know what, you know, the football references. I mean, NWA was minor league compared to WWF's NFL. Vince McMahon came off as, you know, an asshole, which, boom, what a shock. And he was, you know, trying to hold NWA back. But just interesting piece that, you know, that Turner had just been owning the NWA for, what, we're in the ninth month now of his ownership. So, yeah, you know, it's a national news deal, but it just, like I said, made him look minor league and sad, which, yeah, it is what it is. Also going on, they have signed a deal with Channel 69 in Atlanta, WBEU, which is interesting because when they got on TBS in 85, there was always a deal that TBS had where they didn't want any other NWA programming on in the market. Yep. And they didn't have it for 4 years. The only way I saw it, since I lived between Atlanta and Macon, was I would watch it on the Macon channels.
And Macon's so, technically a different market?
Yes.
Okay.
Because Macon is 2 hours south of Atlanta. So, yes, a totally different deal. So, I watched syndicated shows there. But the syndicated shows got on Channel 69. And this was also close to the time period where Joe Pedicino had left Channel 36 and taken his programming over to 69. So, I can't remember exactly when that was, but that was a pretty big deal. And, you know, was it Philly had a big block of television, right, in that time period? Didn't they have like a sort of what Atlanta had?
Maybe. I'm not sure. And
there was nothing like, though, Atlanta. You know, the deal where, I mean, you watch TBS, even before TBS, I know one of the channels would air Superstars because they wouldn't allow Superstars on Pedicino for years because of the Superstars of Wrestling deal where he had – that was the name of his show, and that was the name of their show. And wasn't there a legal situation with that, Bix?
I don't know if there was one between Pedicino and WWF, but there was that Albert Patterson guy who sued WWF several times.
Yeah, but they would not air that. They air Challenge instead. So Superstars would be on one. That would always air like the hour before TBS. So you would start like 5 o'clock. And you would have wrestling from 5 o'clock until 3 the next morning. Every Saturday night. So, you know, as a kid, 10 hours of wrestling. And that's just Atlanta, you know, being, you know, in Macon. That we had wrestling on before that. So I don't know. Where were you living at when you were a youth?
All over the place. So let's see. This would have been 89 we're talking about. I would have been in Singapore at this time.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so there wasn't a whole lot of wrestling going on in Singapore at that time, I would think, other than the tours that would go through every now and then, correct? Did you ever go to any of those shows?
No, I don't think I was aware that they were running occasional shows in Singapore while I was there, and I only sort of became a wrestling fan towards the sort of the end of that period. But they did get the WWF syndicated shows there. Well, at least one of them.
Like International Wrestling Challenge or whatever.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it was the American version. It was just 6 months behind, which, as I've mentioned before in other shows, was led to great excitement in my young life when I returned to the States and was able to find out all the results of like what had happened, of like all the conclusions of all these feuds that I've been following, just like bam, hitting me, you know, just immediately. it was very exciting.
That's awesome. As a kid, man, you know, I was 10 years old in 89, just having all that wrestling on, just back to back to back to back, and it was all, everything, you know, all your major promotions. It's fantastic. Joe Pedicino was a hero of my childhood. You know, can't talk about him enough. But I also signed a deal with CTV in Canada this time period, where they would start airing their programming on CTV in September. Canada was an interesting market for NWA. I mean, after the whole situation where Jack Tunney left to go with Vince in 84, I mean, they came through a little bit. They worked with Angelo Mosca for a couple shows and then came back in 88 and started working a little bit more.
Tony Condello,
yeah. And actually, they went to Western Canada too, Winnipeg and stuff like that. But I think Canada's underrated as far as their effect in the wrestling war, because you look at, you know, when they went to WWF, WWF immediately just put their foot down, especially Toronto, man, and was very strong in that area. And I think it's one of those what ifs in wrestling. If Jim Crockett would have been smart enough to keep sending, you know, bigger name guys instead of his low carders up there, and would have kept Toronto as an NWA stronghold.
That's such a weird chicken and the egg thing, though, because
different? Yeah, how different would it have been?
The Vince deal was such a good deal, though, that he offered Honey. Plus, Vince still would have gotten Stu's TVs, and Stu had a lot of good TV in different parts.
Well, he would have had Western Canada, definitely. Yeah. But Eastern Canada would have been interesting. I mean, they had Montreal locked down, but Toronto, yeah. And Toronto's known for being this huge WWF town, even today, even though they can't get any major shows there because of who knows what the fans. But, I mean, it's such a major market that if it would have stayed with NWA, it could have been real different. I mean, we may not have had WrestleMania 5. I mean, WrestleMania 6 in Toronto.
Might not even have had WrestleMania 3 in Detroit.
Could, yeah. So it's, you know, one of those big what ifs. More NWA. Then this was an interesting one. They signed a merchandise deal with Roots, where for a line of shoes at the time, and had some of the funniest commercials that would come out later in the year. This is, you know, was it the Steiners, the Road Warriors, Sting, Luger had one. Flair never had one.
I think Z-Man might have had one.
Z-Man had one, but. Yeah, they, and eventually you got the ruse pads in the corners and all that other stuff. And, you know, Rick Steiner would wear one ruse and one wrestling boot. But, Bix, talk about the ruse deal and how, you know, for years the situation with merchandise with NWA or what Crockett Promotions was so bad. And now, you know, we got, you know, the new NWA and they're already striking a big deal.
Yeah, ruse, shoes for your feet, pockets for your stuff. And, oh my god, they still exist.
Yeah,
I just googled ruse shoes and now they're called Kanga ruse with the ruse part all capitalized, but I guess they still exist. But I never really understood those, at least specifically because like the pockets are not exactly that big. Like you can put a little bit of change in there, but that's about it. But yeah, Crockett did have more merchandise I think than people realized. Yeah, they had the training cards, and they also had some licensing deals. Like, they had the 7-Eleven deals and stuff like that. But, this was their first big inroads into anything like that under Turner. And then it would be the next year that they would, you know, that they would start to make a lot more licensing deals, like the action figures and the other assorted toys and stuff.
Yeah, with
like
Galoob.
That. Galoob, Just Toys, all sorts of different, like, companies and... All of them, if you ever noticed, all of them always had the same wrestlers, too, for some reason. Like, the exact same dozen wrestlers. but, yeah, I mean, that was probably something where Turner definitely helped them. Probably, yeah. You know what I mean.
Yeah, and, it's a big deal. Also, they had to deal with Coors for a while. They had the Coors logo in the corner and stuff.
And the Coors replay, you know, Coors Slam of the Week type thing. Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting because... You know, no wrestling company had been associated with beer before. I mean, boxing was always associated with alcohol, at least from the 80s, you know, where the Budweiser logos in the ring and all the other stuff. But, yeah, I mean, it was just crazy to see a beer company involved in a wrestling company. But, Todd, you think WWF was the king of the merchandising, you know, deals this time period, and still are. Do you think that was one of the main reasons why, you know, WCW, NWA was looked at minor league, was they weren't going hard enough outside of the ring to expose themselves to more fans?
No, I don't. I don't think that was one of the reasons, but I think it was symptomatic of the reasons why people perceived them that way. Like they didn't, whereas Vince was very good at sort of marketing the company to a lot of different outside people and sort of telling the story of his company, which speaks to what you were talking about earlier as far as Inside Edition and how other people would cover it. I think that the merchandising was part of that general trend, which is the NWA wasn't as good at capitalizing on those things as WWF was doing. But I don't think that people were looking at merchandising saying, hey, that's the reason why these people are second rate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's basically what I was getting at was, it was, emblematic of what it was, the bigger problem is their heads were buried in the sand. You know, a lot of times, and weren't looking outside the box for trying to get, more revenue, I guess you could say, and that went on for many, many years. But, the television situation at this time period, which we transition to the next story, Jim Ross was basically dominating television. At this point, he was the lead announcer on World Championship Wrestling, Worldwide Wrestling, the Power Hour, which just started the month earlier. Was he also the main event at this time too, Biggs? I think the only show he went hosting was Pro, right?
I'm trying to think back because they changed stuff around. They changed the announcers around a bunch of times in '89, so I can't really remember who was where when. Because at first, Lance Russell was brought in to host Worldwide, but that didn't last that long. And then he maybe got moved to Pro. And then then Lance also hosted Main Event. There was a bunch of different stuff that got moved around. So I don't remember.
I think Chris Cruz was at Worldwide maybe around this time.
No, that wasn't until later, I don't think.
Okay. But yeah, that's right.
Well, the original idea, though, was that led Schiavone to quit was that Ross would host TBS shows and Schiavone would host the syndication shows. I think each would also be the producer of those shows. And Schiavone saw it as a demotion. And then Lance was sort of hired to replace him, but not exactly.
Yeah, and that's leading to this story. This week in '89, they had talked to Ken Resnick, who, of course, AWA guy, had worked with Vince for a while.
Had he actually been anywhere since he left WWF?
Not at that point, no. Because he would turn up later on working with,
LPWA.
LPWA, and then work with... Alperstein, right, in AWF.
Yes, years later, though.
Yeah, years later. But, yeah, Ken Resnick was contacted about hosting Worldwide Wrestling, and he turned it down. I mean, who is Ken Resnick to turn out a job like that? But who knows?
He must have had the non-wrestling, good non-wrestling job.
Yeah, I guess so. But, so you finally mentioned Schiavone is, he quit because of that role. But then he left WWF, and when he came back, that's the role he was in.
Yes.
So, yeah, I guess you pick your battle sometimes, but it didn't necessarily work out for Tony. And which, he wanted to be closer to home anyway, so, whatever for him. But on that note, we're going to take a quick break and let the Place to Be Nation guys pay the bills. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a matchup that could have happened between a boxer and a wrestler, and that was being promoted by the wrestler, but it was nowhere near close to happening. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past through Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacemanNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only place to be nation podcast network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Elner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows, not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, we're back. The Place to Be guys got their plugs in, so let's continue with this show discussing July 20th through 26th, 1989. And now we're going to be in a situation where it's not really wrestling we're talking about, but it's involving a wrestler. Bam Bam Bigelow, who at this time period was basically a free agent, working independents, bouncing around. And he was going out and telling people that he was going to be fighting Mike Tyson at the Tokyo Dome in 1990. And he was supposed to make an announcement during the George Foreman, Everett Bigfoot Martin fight on July 20th, which this time period, George was in the middle of his big comeback. He was fighting a lot of lower class guys, but it was a big deal. And I think this fight was on ESPN. Sounds about right. It was on ESPN Top Rank Boxing. And Bigelow said he was going to be on the show, and he was going to give an interview on the show about how he was going to become, you know, a pro boxer. Well, the show happens. No Bam Bam Bigelow, of course. And then as a couple weeks went on, it basically came out that he wasn't going to fight Tyson. This was all just a, you know, grandstand deal. And then he eventually started back working with Memphis. But it's interesting. You know, Tyson's a guy I would say it started maybe in 88, where they started talking about maybe doing a match with Hogan. That I know the magazines, the aftermaths definitely were pimping that deal. I don't know if there were ever any actual serious talks between Vince and Don King, but I mean, it was talked about. And then, of course, the next, you know, in 90, Tyson was supposed to be the referee on the February Saturday Night's Main Event show, which, of course, he lost to Buster Douglas, and Buster Douglas took the spot. But yeah, Tyson and wrestling, you know, even though he eventually came and did it in 98, was something that always would come up every so often. Biggs, Mike Tyson and Bam Bam Bigelow. If that match ever happened, I mean, what do you think? How do you think that would have went down?
Well, it went in a boxing match, so Tyson would have won.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they weren't doing a different style fight as, you know, Japan would call it. I mean, it was going to be a straight boxing match.
I mean, it honestly wouldn't surprise me if someone like Bigelow could get sponsors to have a boxing career. Although, I don't know if that's a more recent thing. Like, you know, the whole thing with Big Show a few years ago, which, by the way, last I checked, is still in court. Though they were Big Show violated his contract with Sobe Entertainment to go back to WWE, which was, what, 2008? That's still in court. So, but, I mean, it wouldn't shock me if someone like Bigelow could get something like that going, but very weird. Bigelow was in a weird place at this point, though, because, I mean, he didn't even have Japan, right? I mean, he was just working, like, indies and occasional shots in Memphis and stuff, right?
Yeah, he had just settled his legal issues with Larry Sharp.
Which meant he could go back to Japan.
Which meant he'd go back to Japan, yeah. And they wouldn't have the match in Japan because Mike Tyson was mega over in Japan.
Yep.
So, I mean, and Buzz Bigelow had a name there. So that would, I mean, I think it could have worked as far as drawing, maybe the Tokyo Dome. You know, eventually Tyson went there and fought Buster Douglas. But Todd, the deal with Tyson at the time, though, was Tyson had cleaned out the heavyweight division. I mean, he beat everybody. There was nobody really left in the fight. Although Foreman was starting to come on. Vander was about to start, you know, making his way up. He had just beat Michael Doakes in March for one of the secondary titles. So, I mean, there were guys on the horizon, but like I said, Tyson was, I mean, there was talk that he was going to fight Tony Mandarich at one point, which would have been insane. You know, guys like Bigelow, Tony Mandarich, I mean, those are the guys that Tyson had to pick from. And it was just a weird time for Tyson because he fought, let's see, I'm trying to remember exactly who he fought. Frank Bruno. And then he took a long break after that, like almost a year. So, and then he came back and lost to Buster Douglas. Talk about Mike Tyson and his aura dominance in 1989,
88,
that era.
Well, I mean, I wasn't following boxing at the time, so I wouldn't be really the right person to really get into it. I mean, I was, you know, I became a boxing fan later on. I don't know how far along the discussions were at this point. I'd assume it was still at the point when, you know, both sides are sort of throwing around ideas and sort of trying to get things to their liking. But I don't sense that. I mean, obviously, Bam Bam Bigelow and Mike Tyson, I don't think would have meant a lot in the U.S. because at this point in time, he didn't really have that much of a presence in the U.S. It had been a few years since he'd been. I was actually thinking it was a little bit later. So it would have been. Let's see. When was he last with Titan?
He was with 80, and then he was in WCW a few months later for a very short run.
Yeah, he worked Starrcade and he left, I think, in either December or January 89.
That's right. He had one big match in WCW during that time period.
Barry Windham, U.S. title.
That's right. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, so he was sort of like – I mean, he was sort of a side character really more than anything else. So I don't think it would have meant a lot. I think – it would have meant more in Japan as sort of a novelty because that's the sort of thing that they would get into. But I don't know it would mean a lot there either. I mean, when Bam Bam Bigelow did a shoot a few years later against Kimo, a guy that's much more known in the States, they did that in Japan, and it was, you know, an exclusive Japan show. So it seems more up Japan's alley than the U.S.'s alley. And, you know, as far as Tyson goes, I mean, in spite of there not being a lot of opponents necessarily on the horizon at that point in time, I mean, he was still such an iconic figure that it didn't matter that much. I mean, you're always looking for sort of the next big thing, but I mean, just like with, you know, Ronda Rousey right now in the UFC, there may not be any sort of big opponent on the horizon for her, but she's reached a level where they can just, you know, feed her cans, which is essentially what she's doing this weekend, and it'll still draw pretty well.
Yeah, totally. And
So I brought up Tyson's box rec profile. Because you said the Foreman fight was on the 20th, right?
Yes.
So he fought the next night against and beat Carl Williams in Atlantic City.
Call the Truth Williams. That's right. God, I forgot about that fight. Yeah. Call the Truth Williams, one of my favorite boxing names. of the year. And then and he went fighting until Douglas. That's right. Yeah. So that sounds about right. It was, and a lot of people have talked about that Don had seen what Vince McMahon had been doing with Zeus. And he wanted in on something like that as well, which we'll talk about Zeus in a little bit. But so, you know, Don King's always looking out to make a buck. So, you know, there's nothing new about him trying to find freak shows.
Did you see him last weekend or the weekend after on before the fight with Amir Imam?
Yes.
That was a tremendous performance by Don King, who just seemed completely out of it. But hey,
you gotta remember, Don is he's in his 70s, deep in his 70s, and he's still going. You know, he's still going strong. He doesn't have the names like he used to have, but he's still out there with his flags and his denim jacket and everything else in the hair. So he's still going strong. I'll give it to old Don. But speaking of Japan, we're going to go to Japan now and talk about All Japan. And on July 22nd, we had an All Japan World Tag Team title change as Jumbo Shiruda and Yoshiaki Yatsu defeated Stan Hansen and Tenryu. And Tenryu said after the match that if they didn't regain the titles, they would quit teaming again. They would never team again. And that's what happened eventually down the line. But Jumbo and Yatsu was a team that doesn't get nearly talked about enough, Big. So I thought they were awesome together.
Yeah, I really like the Olympics. What it is, though, this was Yatsu's last big run after Joshu left, the SWS and more stuff is underrated, but this was his last, like, really, really good and high profile, and, you know, in terms of great matches, too, run after Choshu and company left All Japan. I mean, this, especially the match they had later in the year against Hansen and Tenryu in the Tag League Finals is incredible. And that's one of his really last great big performances. So this is a really good feud, and Yatsu's really good at this point. But yeah, he meshed really well with Jumbo. I mean, very different team from Yatsu and Choshu, but really, really good. I mean, I don't even like the, you know, not the big super like work rate Midnight Express team like he was with Choshu or with the other Choshu stable guys like Hamaguchi, but just very good, solid tag team and really good chemistry with Hansen and Tenryu.
Oh, yeah. And well, Tenryu was awesome. And on that note, Todd, Tenryu is a guy who doesn't nearly get talked about enough himself either. I mean, he was one of the best guys in the world in this time period. And this was, you know, the year before he will leave, and, you know, Revolution, fantastic, you know, stable with Kawada and Fuyuki and Ashurahara, who was long gone by this time. But talking about Tenryu and his legacy as a performer.
Well, I mean, this is the last period that he really had that, you know, upper echelon talent to be able to work with on a you know, day-to-day basis, because, you know, the next year when he left, I mean, you can't blame the guy. He got offered an incredible contract.
Totally.
By, you know, the SWS guys. And, you know, I think anybody in his position would have taken that money. But, I mean, there were trade-offs. You know, he had to go to a company that was a startup that didn't have anywhere near the same level of talent. And it meant that he wasn't going to be there in All Japan when, you know, the next generation moved to the top with Misawa and Kawada and Kobashi. So, you know, Tenryu's sort of a weird what if, in that, you know, if that offer hadn't come along at that period of time, he would have had a very different career. And I think he would have been a very key figure, particularly when Jumbo's health sort of went on the decline. And I mean, granted, Tenryu was getting up there in age as well, so it wasn't like he was going to be able to go at the same level that he'd been able to.
Except when he did later.
Yeah, but I mean, that was on a much more sporadic basis. I don't think he would have been able to keep up with the All Japan schedule in like maybe the mid-90s when they were just going crazy. Because, I mean, you look at how the guys that were in their 20s held up to, you know, that style of work. And, you know, Tenryu would have been substantially older at that period of time. I think he would have broken down relatively quickly. But again, I mean, that's the whole point. It's a complete we don't know.
Well, the style also might not have gone in that,
exactly,
that direction.
That's what I was going to bring up.
Yeah, if you don't have those guys ruling the main event.
Because Tenru doesn't leave, we probably do not get, you know, Tiger Mask unmasking of Misawa that at that time period. And that totally changes the game. You know,
he
was the catalyst for that whole change.
The specific timing of it, as far as like, we're going to do that right now. But I mean, I think that was going to come.
Oh, definitely.
One way or another within, yeah, you know, a year or two. So I think that, you know, the specific timing of it would have broken a little bit, but I think the overall trajectory would have been basically the same either way. We don't know. I mean, it really, the whole thing is a very, you know, a very interesting what if.
Yeah, it's a definite one of the best, I think, in wrestling history in a lot of ways. Because, I mean, All Japan at this time period, they had just started going to all clean finishes on the Tokyo shows after years of screw jobs and all your main matches. So they were changing that deal. Tenryu had just beaten, or he hadn't done it yet, but he was beat Baba clean, which nobody did. You know, in a tag match, eventually Baba, you know, got it back on him. But Tenryu was going to be the guy, and then he left and took the money. Which, like you said, I don't blame anybody for doing that. You know, if they put the money in front of your face, you jump at it. I mean,
$750 a year plus points in the promotion or something like
that. Your worth what somebody's willing to pay you. And if they're willing to pay you that, then I'm all for it. And the thing was, he wasn't the original choice.
On that note, Chris, too, like, just to make it clear to people, like, this, when we say, like, you know, oh, you go with the best offer, this isn't like even, you know, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, where they're getting, you know, more money, but it's not. It's more money and it's guaranteed money from WCW with lesser dates, but it's not like sort of like a, you know, an exponential thing. I mean, the offer that Tenryu got during that period was crazy guaranteed money. I mean, it was basically unprecedented as far as the amount of money that was being thrown around. So, I mean, this was the sort of offer that native Japanese wrestlers were not getting up to that period of time and haven't really gotten since as far as guarantees.
And he wasn't the original choice, as I was about to say. Maeda was, because the company that started SWS was a sponsor of UWF. And they had seen how successful UWF was at running the Tokyo Dome with zero television, I might say. And they were selling it out. And they were thinking, wow, we got to get in this business. And they wanted to start up around Maeda. Maeda turned them down, which is a big mistake on his part. And then Tenryu took it, and the rest is history. But you mentioned Kobashi, and it was on the same show where Kobashi got his first big singles win. It was a count out victory, but it was a big win over Shunji Takano, who eventually would go to work for SWS down the line, and the Ashinaro tournament, which was kind of like their Young Lions type deal that other organizations would run. And the winner of the tournament, which I can't remember who won it, but they would get a triple shot, a shot the triple crown down the line. But Kobashi, Todd, another guy, we talk about Brian Pillman as being a natural. We've watched all the All Japan stuff for the Death Valley Driver Best of the 80s set, and you could see early, like first match early in his career, this guy had it. He was a natural, no doubt, and with the right seasoning, which he got, he was going to be, you know, one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, I mean, he had everything going for him, and that he had a bunch of really talented guys to work with very on from very early on. They moved him along slowly so he could sort of pick up the business, you know, over time without sort of being overexposed from a young time. And once, you know, once they really ran with him, you know, I mean, he had. I mean, as far as work goes, I mean, I think it's very easy to argue the best run in pro wrestling history as far as putting together great matches over an extended period of time.
Yeah, and Shunji Takano, I want to talk about him real quick, because this is the guy who he had the look of the Japanese Barry Windham in a lot of ways. I mean, same type of look as far as body style and the way he was built. He's a guy that could have been bigger in a lot of ways too, but wasn't.
Yeah, he's a guy who probably was worse off than most. I mean, coming out of the SWS thing, because he really had not become a star yet. Like, you know what I mean? Like, Naoki Sano was coming off the Liger feud, so he kind of had a name. Obviously, Tenryu was a big star. Kabuki was a big star, but he was older. But you get what I'm saying? Like, it was really like the Takano. Now, him and George were not brothers, right? They just had
yes.
like, the team. Oh, they were brothers.
Yes.
Okay. That wasn't. I was never sure about that.
Yes, they were brothers. Yeah, and Takano definitely a guy who he had potential, but you know, like you said, he just never reached it. And it's funny how he's compared to Barry Windham in that regard too. So, all right, we're moving on, and we're going to move to the female side of All Japan. All Japan women, and a big retirement. Lioness Asuka, one half of the famous Crush Gals from the '80s, was forced to retire on July 25th. Due to reaching the mandatory age limit at the time of 26 25. Years old. Bix, talk about how that whole deal worked with the Joshi promotions and why the age limit.
They thought that past that age that the women would become less marketable and all that, and they would be too old. Plus, they wanted to cycle in new stars. And it was something that as great promoters as they were, for the most part, they were clearly very wrong about this, because even early on, you had women who, like Devil Masami, who went to the original JWP and did fairly well there. Not that the original JWP did great, but still. And then as time went on, especially, I mean, you know, the Crush Gals were still drawing over a decade after this. It's ridiculous. And what was I going to say? Now, I'm trying to remember, though. Did Chigusa retire before or after this?
Oh, God. I think Chigusa was after, because she was younger.
Okay.
But not by much. It was like a year after.
Yeah.
And they had broke up and were feuding.
Right.
You know, in this time period for the WWA championship. And you know, Lioness, of course, would come back, as they always did. You know, she came back in 94, you know, forming the Reading Array with Yokota and Bison Kimura, and worked for quite a while. You know, eventually retired in 2005, where she reformed the Crush Gals one more time with Nagayo, beating Chigayo Nakashima and Sugar Sato at the 10th anniversary Gaia show. But Todd, you know, today, you know, the big deal about WWE is, you know, give divas a chance and this, that, and the other, and give the women longer matches on television. What, you know, a lot of people don't remember was in the 80s, you know, the Jumping Bomb Angels, they were in there. The Crush Gals went in too, right, Vix? Didn't they go in?
Just did a couple shots at MSG in Boston Garden.
Yeah.
But it seemed
it was
like
very brief,
things,
though.
Yeah, it seemed like one of those things where WWF just... I think it was one of those things where they just brought him in because there had been, like, those mainstream stories. Like, what was it? Wall Street Journal? About how big Chigusa was?
Yeah.
And they brought them in against Dump Matsumoto and Bull Nakano. And they just didn't really do anything with them. I mean, you know, with the Jumping Bond Angels in 87 and 88, at least they kind of had an idea of what they wanted
to
do.
Yeah, and that's where I was getting at with Todd is... They got over. Those matches got over with Leilani Kai and Judy Martin. Talk about, you know, the stigma of women's wrestling and the male fans and not getting over.
Well, the key with the Bomb Angels was that when they brought in the Crush Gals were more mat-oriented and more physical at that period of time, whereas the Jumping Bomb Angels were more high flyers. So the Bomb Angels were more what WWF was wanting, was sort of high-flying, exciting moves rather than sort of a style that didn't necessarily connect as well with the WWF fans. So that's why they ended up using the Bomb Angels rather than the Crush Gals, at least as I understand.
Well, it wasn't the only reason, because – you have to remember the psychology of Japan in terms of what, especially All Japan women at that time, what the Matsunaga brothers thought would get over was very different. I mean, this is a period where they wanted the women to be kind of not masculine, but kind of asexual, in that they gave them the short haircuts. They really avoided any kind of like swimsuit connotation or anything to it all, and the Jumping Bomb Angels were the more effeminate with the long hair and all that, they worked better for an American audience in that sense because of the look aspect.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. That also played a role. And as far as them getting over and what it might suggest about the women today, I mean, that was a different style than most WWF wrestlers who were wrestling at that time period. You know, that was a more sort of slower, mat-based period. So the Jumping Bomb Angels stood out in that period of time. Whereas today, even the women that are very good, you know, Charlotte, Sasha Banks, while they're talented as wrestlers, there isn't a lot really that they do that's different than from what the men offer, which I think makes it more difficult for them to stand out in this period of time. So, I mean, it's just a different era as far as I'm getting over. And going back to something that Bix said earlier, I don't know that I agree that the age restrictions were ultimately a mistake. I mean, I can see the argument for it not being the right way to go, but I mean, that was the model that stood up during the period that they did the best, and the time period when that model broke down was the time period when the, you know, Japanese women's wrestling became over time less popular. Now, granted, there were periods there where Japanese wrestling was very successful when the period changed. But, you know, the glory period was when they were able to enforce that better. And I think that there were some real benefits to that system. You know, it forced you to cycle in new people. It created a connection with younger girls where you didn't have these sort of older women that were sort of not necessarily as connecting with the young talent, with the young talent that you had. And I think it allowed them to maintain more control over the talent. Eventually it sort of broke down because other promotions started up. They used the successful talent that beforehand hadn't really had anywhere to go once they reached a certain age. And at that point, it sort of forced all the promotions to sort of follow the same lead. But I'm not sure that as far as, like, you know, if you say, you know, we're building this women's promotions for 30 years, are we better off enforcing this thing or not enforcing this thing? I'm not sold that the original plan might not have been the better plan for the long route.
And I can get behind that. But if you're going to do that, though, you better make sure you have the young talent coming that can, you know, carry it on.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that's definitely about it. Moving on to the other half of Japan, New Japan, they were not on tour at this time period. But the boss, Antonio Inoki, won a seat on the Japanese House of Representatives. And this was a big deal. You know, this is the first time that I think a wrestler had been involved in politics in Japan that I can think of. Yeah. And, you know, he had a lot of the New Japan guys were campaigning for him, especially Hiroshi Hase, which is funny considering where he would end up doing the same thing later on. But it changed New Japan in a lot of ways because Inoki is now focusing on his political career. And he's turning over the wrestling portion to Seiji Sakaguchi. And Todd, I think it's, you know, it was pretty evident at the time that, you know, with Sakaguchi and Choshu in control, New Japan shifted from that, you know, shooter-based style to a more wrestling, I guess you could maybe even say flashier style. And Inoki leaving had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a gradual thing because, and we still had the, you know, the Russians coming in, which very, very much fit into that sort of theme, and you still had sort of some of those trappings for a little while. But yeah, over time, it sort of cycled into what it became in the 90s, which was, you know, more I'm hesitant to say it's sort of traditional wrestling, because what does traditional wrestling even mean? But away from sort of Inoki's vision for wrestling. And I mean, Inoki is one of the more complicated figures in wrestling. I mean, there's so many pros and cons to the various things he did. But, I mean, this was a period in Japan here in the late 80s where there was a lot of resentment towards the guy, both in terms of, like, the way that he managed the promotion to the way that he booked himself, particularly in contrast to Baba, as Baba was sort of cycling himself down the card and Inoki still wanted to be the top guy, you know, even as Choshu and Maeda were getting really hot. That, you know, I think Inoki, you know, stepping back from the promotion to a degree was a definite positive for New Japan, and was one of the keys to the promotion, sort of setting things up for a very successful run in the 90s.
Right, and all the complications he had from the diabetes, too, meant that he really was not an effective main event performer anymore anyway.
Exactly, and that's pretty much why he did that retirement, which, of course, you know, he would come back from a few times after the fact, but that's wrestling. But Bix, talk about Inoki as a... Now, hit outside the ring, you know, the politician, the entrepreneur, you know, just Inoki as a character, I guess you could say.
There are some fascinating articles about this on the internet if you really want to take the time to look for it. God, where do you start? Making deals with China when no one would do that, with the Soviet Union,
North Korea.
Making deals with both Chinas when no one else would do it.
Yeah. Running the show in Russia, you know, going to Russia.
Going to China.
Yeah. I mean, Inoki, his political clout and just his charisma. I mean, he's one of the all-timers, man. I mean, he's definitely a used car salesman. He could talk you into anything in a lot of ways, and a lot of people, you know, were suckered by him over the years, and he would get a lot of guys convinced that what he was doing was right, and he was perfect as a politician, no doubt. I mean, he found his true calling in that regard, and there's no doubt about that. And like I said, how long did he stay in office? And I know he got reelected many times, but he was in office for a long time, wasn't he, Bix?
You mean the original, before he finally lost an election, you mean?
Yeah.
It was, what, consecutively until, like, late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah. So, he got reelected numerous times.
And now, so,
Wasn't there a big scandal in the first one before the second? A scandal in the second run. I feel like there was a breakup in there when he got into some trouble, and then he came back, and then he got into trouble again.
I mean, there are so
I remember something about it, but I can't remember exactly what it was. But he was like, again, Teflon, man. It just fell off of him because of who he was. It's crazy. And you know, we see a lot of politicians today that have that same type of presence about them, that they can get, you know, they have all this negative stuff against them, but hey, they keep on winning elections. But
okay, yeah. So he failed to win election in 95 when there were some scandals in 94, and then he returned in 2013. So,
and it's funny that in 95 that's when he came back and did the North Korea show with Flair. So it's good, interesting timing there.
And for anyone who hasn't read the article on Sports Illustrated's website about that, go do that now.
Yeah, that is a really good article, no doubt. All right, we're going to stay outside of the United States, and we're moving to Canada, where Stampede Wrestling is in one of its many incarnations, and Owen Hart has returned from being away in Japan for a while, and he comes back on July 20th, and he saves Davey Boy Smith from an attack by Dynamite Kid and Johnny Smith, who were the heels at the time, the new British Bulldogs, and eventually led to Owen and Dynamite doing a run of house of matches around the house shows and stuff. But Owen Hart, Biggs, he was so great as a worker at this time period. And it's a shame that not a lot of people have seen him in this era and only remember him for his work in WWF, because he was a guy that, you know, he looked, you know, we talk about on the show guys that look like futures of the business. He was a guy that was touted as the future of the business.
Yeah, I mean, really from the beginning of his career, I mean, certainly from the beginning of his full-time career in 86. But I mean, if you look at the little bit of stuff from when he ended up going to Europe last minute in 83, when he instead just as a fun, like, European vacation with his brother, and he's good then. And that's basically just him barely having done anything. I mean, he was a very, very special talent. I mean, as good, he was still a really good to excellent worker after he blew out his knee a few years later. But he was just so, and it wasn't even just the flying that he lost too. I mean, just everything, the aggression, the suplexes. I mean, he was such a complete wrestler, but he was very flashy and marketable. I mean, very, yeah, I mean, you have to just watch that stuff from Calgary or Japan or even England from back then to really just get the, an idea of just how good he was.
Yeah, I mean, he had great matches with Keiichi Yamada, of course, who was Liger. He had the other Japan matches.
Koshinaka,
Takada. Yeah, he just a fantastic guy. But Dynamite. Dynamite was a guy who was based, you know, he had that rep himself in the early 80s. But by this time, he was pretty broken down from injuries and other situations, I guess we could say. But Todd, talk about the, you know, Dynamite Kid and how, you know, he just became a physical wreck around this time period.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to add to that. I mean, that's sort of the crux of it. I mean, he was a guy that that really just destroyed his body for the business. I mean, he was such a, you know, a reckless force of nature, you know, in that period, particularly in the early to mid 80s. And, you know, the human body just isn't made to endure what he was going through. And so this was, you know, this was the comeuppance. And sadly for the guy, I mean, it was, you know, it was just, things only fell apart from here. And, you know, he's been consumed, you know, confined to a wheelchair for, you know, for 20 years now as sort of a, you know, a cautionary tale, much like, you know, Chris Benoit, a guy that, you know, very much molded himself after, after Dynamite Kid's style and, you know, went down a very, you know, a different as far as the specifics, but you know, a similar, you know, fall from grace once, you know, once the physical style caught up with them.
Do you consider Dynamite, and I'm not, you know, Benoit would agree, but do you consider them as guys that maybe Daniel Bryan should look at and think, do I really need to come back and end up in that type of physical condition in the long run? Or what is your opinion on that?
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned with the cautionary tale, I mean, those are the sorts of, you know, the sorts of stories that there's a lot of in wrestling. And anyone that's, you know, that's working a physical style needs to consider that sort of thing. I think Daniel Bryan has always been a guy that's had more caution about that sort of thing. And at times he's eschewed that, you know, but if you read his book, you know, he's always been thinking about that, even, you know, with the most violent matches that he was doing with Nigel McGuinness, it was always something that was on his mind. You know, like, I don't want to go too far. I don't want to press my body past the breaking point. And there were a lot of period points, you know, even, you know, on the indies when he was sort of on his way up, where he was working a relatively conservative style. You know, it was very, you know, very entertaining matches, but not necessarily ones where he was doing a ton. And so I think that's something that, you know, has always been something that he's thought about. And so I don't think he necessarily needs, you know, needs as much of a reminder as other guys that I think probably don't think about it as much as he does.
Yeah. Yeah. It was sad to watch Dynamite, especially when he came back and worked the These Days show for Michinoku Pro in 96. I mean, he just looked so terrible on that show, man. It was just it's a shame to watch guys that were so great and so talented that, you know, they just fall apart. It's sad. All right, moving on down the road a little bit into the States and the Pacific Northwest. We have some interesting situations going on the July 22nd in Portland. We have Scotty DeBody, who is, of course, Scotty Flamingo, Raven, working a musclehead gimmick at this time period. He's tagging up with Top Gun, who was the legendary David Sierra, Cuban Assassin. And they had a little situation where they teamed up with Jonathan Boyd, against Beetlejuice, who is Art Barr, and the Southern Rockers, Steve Dahl and Scott Peterson, where Scotty hit Top Gun by mistake, costing the match. Top Gun and Boyd then jump Scotty, and then Steve Dahl makes a save. Bix, Scotty the Body. Even into Scotty Flamingo, talk about how Scott Levy was. I mean, this world's different in this role than he was as Raven.
Yeah, I mean, you know what's weird about it though is that Raven would like do stuff where he basically like when he did commentary on was it Sunday Night Heat, where he kind of did turn back into Scotty the Body, at least in the way he talked.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, for people who've never seen Scotty the Body, but if you saw that, if you saw when he did commentary on Heat, I mean, that's kind of what he was like as the early, Scotty the Body, Scott Anthony, Scotty Flamingo stuff.
People might be familiar with more with Johnny Polo.
Johnny Polo,
yeah. Yep. Because it's weird too, because when he started and he had that run in Memphis, he was terrible on promos. I mean, it's amazingly bad. But then, within a year or so, he goes to Portland and he really got things together. And he was one of the last stars of that territory. I mean, he really put things together. I mean, I honestly have not seen that much of the Portland stuff. I think I've seen more like the global stuff and like the other, other national stuff with him. But he was just such a good, like creative, like just cocky, douchey heel. I like just think of like just all the lines he'd come up with. Like I think about in Global, the one I always think about is when he called Scott Hudson Baldilocks.
Yes, yes. Because Scott had that little bit of blondish hair, yeah, and with the big bald spot. So yeah, and he was really strong in Memphis when he went back in '93 as Scotty Flamingo, managed by Sensational Sherry. And yeah, he's a guy that I loved him in this type of gimmick. And Raven was a great gimmick too for his time, even though it hasn't aged really well over the years, like a lot of stuff in that time period. But yeah, he was a hell of a guy on interviews and promos and stuff like that. But Todd, Art Barr, Beetlejuice was pretty successful. We talked about dynamic dudes as a gimmick, but Beetlejuice, of course, the movie was 2 years old by this point. And he worked this gimmick for quite a while, even taking it to WCW for a little bit as the juicer. But talking about Art Barr as a performer, man, because we went from Mexico's Love Machine and then eventually teamed up with Eddie and Los Gringos Locos. But he's a guy who died way too young, and nobody really talks about him. But talk about Art Barr as a worker.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with a lot of guys that have died young, it still feels like you sort of got a sense for what they were before they passed away. Art Barr is really a guy where it felt like he was really just sort of scratching the surface of what he was going to do, which to me makes it sadder than a lot of the other wrestling deaths. Well, I mean, more from a selfish standpoint, honestly, than anything else, because from a life standpoint, that doesn't really... a lot of those wrestlers, regardless of where they'd reached on their wrestling careers, they were still leaving behind the same sorts of, stories, of family members that had to, fend for themselves and loved ones that were forced to deal with the loss. But from, just for the standpoint of someone watching the industry, Art Barr is really someone where it's just like a gigantic what if. I mean, you can just imagine that guy with his, with his charisma and his working ability, having been, one of the top stars in ECW, breaking in with WCW around the same time as Benoit and Guerrero and Malenko. And as a personality, he was ahead of all of them. So, I mean, there's, that guy very well could have been one of the biggest superstars in the 1990s. And instead, it's just sort of this gigantic what if. I mean, it's really too bad.
And we still don't really know how and why he died, because it wasn't an overdose. He apparently had some signs of steroid abuse in his body, but he was what, 28? I mean, that's awfully young for like a steroid heart attack type death.
Mysterious.
There was just no like real official cause of death. It's very, very weird. I mean, we just don't know. And then just the stuff with his family, where his son ended up dying in the horseback accident.
Yeah, it's a sad tale, you know. And of course, he had legal issues, which, you know, they were what they were. But anyway, that same night, speaking of Beetlejuice, Al Madrill, who was one of the lead heels at the time in the territory, took this fan who was dressed as Beetlejuice, and supposedly the fan was at the, most of the shows for a while, and was, you know, I guess was a younger kid, and Al always had issues with it. So he took the kid and wiped the paint off the kid's face, you know, which is what a dastardly thing to do. Well, as he's doing this, a guy comes out in a Batman costume, as a la Michael Keaton, which, of course, at this time period, if you remember, Batman was extremely hot in this time period.
Michael Keaton Batman, that's one of those things where if you were not, like, around then, you don't realize how big... I mean, whether it's the Prince soundtrack, but I mean that version of the
merchandise.
Batman,
we talk about merchandising.
Yeah, I mean that version of the Batman logo was everywhere.
Yeah. So anyway, he comes out and he proclaims that he is Batman, and the fans audibly groaned, which was awesome. I haven't seen this. I don't even remember seeing it. You know, when it was first on, when Pettisina was showing North PNW stuff, but it sounded terrible. And he weren't Moondog Moretti.
Wait, so who was it?
They never said. He bought Moondog Moretti, and then it was
Val Kilmer.
Adam West came
Kilmer
back.
Val Kilmer was actually a good Batman.
But Moretti...
I like Val Kilmer as Batman.
I like Val Kilmer. Moretti knocked this stuff out at their head, but Batman pinned him 1-2-3. But the funny thing about this, though, is this happened on July 22nd, 1989. Well, almost exactly 1 year later, Beetlejuice gets payback on Al Madrill and paints his face like his. So they did this angle, and then a year later comes the payoff. I think that's awesome. that they go back to that well, you know, down the line. But yeah, Northwest at this time period was a weird territory. I think Jonathan Boyd was booking at the time period. But yeah, late 80s Pacific Northwest, early 90s was a quite the mixed bag of stuff. Piper was involved, and Denton was involved. Billy Jack was hanging around. Just a weird territory, fun stuff.
And this was really Jonathan Boyd's last run anywhere.
Exactly. And speaking of weirdness, we go to Memphis, we have the debut of Headbanger Ed.
Now, when you say debut, though, he didn't actually work on TV. We're just talking about the video, right?
Yeah, I think he may have had one house show match. That was it. But Todd, I'm pretty sure Todd has never seen this. But Bix, talk about the Headbanger Ed video.
I think I blocked.
And just
a
to
lot
confirm,
of
yes, I have not in fact seen this.
I think I blocked a lot of it out of my mind. I mean, I've only seen it a couple times.
Think of it as okay. Do you remember like Skid Row videos, Todd?
I can't say that I was a big Skid Row guy.
Or any hair metal video of that era, Warrant. Bon Jovi. I guess I was throw Bon Jovi in
White
this thing.
Snake.
White Snake. Any type of like hair metal video that would be on MTV in 1989. Think of it as looking like a public access version.
Yes, this is what I remember. That it looks. It's just so like Memphis was so good at videos even at this point, and this is just the cheapest looking thing you've ever seen.
And Headbanger Ed was a Larry Sharp trainee. He was from Monster Factory.
And a lot of Larry Sharp guys went to, and other New Jersey guys went to Memphis.
Well, there was a pipeline between, you know, the Coraluzzo crew and Larry Sharp and the Memphis. But Headbanger Ed, they show this video, give him this build-up. He works one match in the Mid-South Coliseum in the Tennessee Tag Titles Tournament, which was interesting because at this time period, they were doing tag titles for each state. Cool concept. You know, in their promotion, but the titles eventually ended up like disappearing a month or two later. But he's in that team with Doug Gilbert, and he's never seen again. It was just one of those Memphis deals, man, where they bring in these wild characters, and that's what I'm getting to with Todd. You know, this is the time where Jerry Lawler's booking, and Memphis did a deal where they didn't always stick to this. But it was the formula for many years is that Jerry Jarrett would book 6 months and Jerry Lawler would book 6 months. And it was an interesting deal that, you know, Lawler liked the characters, the monsters. You know, Nightmare Freddy was working in Memphis at this time period. Tommy Gilbert under the mask. getting over too heavily with the fans.
As a kid's baby face,
you know, nonetheless, because Freddie, you know, was supposedly a child molester subtly in the movies, but he's a kid's character to baby face in Memphis.
That's how you know Lawler's booking.
Yeah. Oh. But you know, Lawler's booking this time, and Jerry Jarrett's more
for shame.
Yeah, I know. Lawler, you know, Jerry Jarrett's more traditional, and if you could call it that. You know, but Lawler has got all these wild.
I held off on my joke earlier about Lawler and the All Japan age limits, but you know,
you can go ahead and get me in now because talk about how that concept, you know, makes a lot of sense. You know, when you split it up like that and you keep freshening in and out. I mean, more promotions should have worked with that, don't you think?
With the bookers.
Yeah, don't you think that, Todd? I mean, they have different voices come in and out.
It depends on who you've got there, right? Like, if you've got...
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got people that are smart and you've got a couple people you can rotate to, then, yeah, it can keep people fresh. You know, the flip side of that is that a lot of it, too, depends on the time cycle that you've got in a promotion. You know, Memphis drawing from that, you know, from a relatively small territory and running it frequently had a shorter cycle than a lot of territories did. Whereas if you had, you know, a national television and you're booking over a long haul, you might not want to break things up for 6 months because you might prefer to tell some of the stories over the course of 10 to 12 months. You know, not necessarily the same feud for that time period, but, you know, building from one thing into another thing to another thing. So I think it sort of depends on the territory you're talking about. It's almost sort of a quaint notion now, though, because you've got the model now with WWE is you've got so many voices that, you know, there's no concern about anybody burning out. Because, you know, you've got constant people throwing people at the things at the wall. The problem is you just don't have sort of the consistency in seeing things out because, you know, there are just so many chefs in the kitchen.
Yeah, and the problem is, though, the one guy, though, that makes the final decisions has been doing it for so many damn years that, you know, his vision of what it is what it's supposed to be is, you know, I'm going to say it. I don't know the word I would exactly use for it, but it's just not working, I guess you could say. And you I guess you need that sometimes that different voice to be the leader at times, you know, and it don't necessarily have to be every 6 months, maybe every year or something different, you know, to keep it fresh. You know, that was one of Dusty's big downfalls in Crockett was, you know, he had a nice big run to start off with, good 2 years, 2.5 years. And then that last year and a half or so just, you know, he got tired. They got stale. And that's one thing you can say about Memphis. You know, they never were stale. There was always something different going on. And Jerry Jarrett this time, of course, was in world class. And I don't know if he was himself was doing the booking then.
Not Eric Embry was booking.
Was it? Eric Embry was booking. That's right. Yeah, because Eric Embry's pushing himself to the moon. But world class is, you know, getting ready to do the big angle. You know, where they have Eric Embry and PYU High, where they, you know, world class dies and USWA, you know, rises from the ashes. And there wasn't a whole really lot going on in world class that week, so that's why I'm not really having any notes on them right now. But it was just an interesting time period for the Jarrett promotions because you had talent going back and forth from Memphis to Dallas, and they're working Dallas on Friday nights and someone having to go to Memphis work Saturday morning television. So it's just the bus. I mean, it was just a lot of stuff going on. But anyway, we're moving on to Florida. And at this time period, Dusty had been running PWF.
But Dusty's gone.
Dusty has now left, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But Dusty's left and is back in control of Mike Graham when he run the show, or Steve Kern, or both of them.
It was like Mike Graham, Steve Kern, maybe also Hiro Matsuda.
Yeah. And they basically went back to the old name of FCW. And they were running, you know, using guys like, you know, Steve Kern was there, Dick Slater was coming in,
Scott Hall,
Frankie Lancaster, Brett Sawyer was around.
They actually had a very good crew for a promotion that I'm not even sure if they had like decent TV slots.
They did because I got them on DVD somewhere. DDP
maybe I'm
was
thinking a, later on because they stuck around for a while.
Well, like, DDP and Soli were the announcers.
Yes.
So they had it going on. Well, the Nasty Boys was working there at the time. And the Nasty Boys, really the biggest exposure they had was working AWA by this time period, but they were the champions, tag team champions, and they were asked to do a draw on television. Well, they refused to do it, and they got fired. So I'm thinking, you know, you're the Nasty Boys. How are you refusing to do jobs on this television? I mean, not doing jobs, just do a draw on this television show. Just a weird deal. And to give you a hint of who they had on the roster, here's a show from Orlando on July 23rd. You had Brett Sawyer beating Mike Awesome. That's right. Ron Slinker defeating Dennis Knight, who, of course, will become Tex Slasinger, Phineas Godwin, Midian. Lou Perez, Al's brother, beat Rock Hard Rick.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what a great wrestling name. Kendall Windham beating Jeff James. Jumbo Beretta beating Frankie the Thumper Lancaster. And Steve Kern beating Hoochie Wynn, who I have no idea who that was.
I'm going to guess a Japanese guy. You know,
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, probably. Nick Busick, Dick Slater, and Nasty Boys and Al Perez all no-show. So, and this is 1989 U.S. Indies, and there was a lot of that going on. But Brett Sawyer and Jimmy Backlund, who have, of course, become Jimmy Del Rey, their gimmick at this time was the Playboys. Now, if you've seen Brett Sawyer in this era, Brett Sawyer was really out of shape. So it's just, which, you know, hey, Playboy Buddy Rose. But they were doing, their best business was in the Bahamas, where they were doing like $10,000 a night working in the Bahamas, $10,000 gates. Which that was one of the cool things about working in Florida, man. We go do shows in the Bahamas every week. So good for those guys. But anyway, moving on to another area, Continental, which is one of my all-time favorite areas. The Lethal Weapon, Dennis Condrey, makes his return from quitting NWA in February and beats Tom Pritchard, who was a heel, for the Continental Heavyweight title. And then Dennis Condrey turned heel. He did a double turn. Bix, talk about Dennis Condrey in this era as a singles guy. Because I know you had quite a bit of Continental from this era on tape.
I actually didn't have that much, but I had a lot. What I had was from like this run. I mean, he was really good here. And then also he had the run as the Lethal Weapons team managed by Paul E. with Doug Gilbert, like around the end of the year, beginning of the next year in ICW. He was just a very good top heel. I mean, I think they just worked out a deal where he would come in because he was a guy who was a name in the territory, but I don't think he was working a full schedule, right? I think he was going back to Colorado between like some of the bigger shows, right?
Well, he worked the major shows for sure.
But I don't think he was working every town around the loop, right?
No, he wasn't working Columbus, Mississippi, I don't think, or something like that.
But he's a very underrated worker in general.
Totally, totally. And he was really, really strong in this role as a singles guy. But Tom Pritchard, the rumors going around this time, Todd, and these rumors will go around for quite a while, was that he was going to eventually go to the NWA. He's another guy that, what if? I mean, if he would have ever got on with one of the major companies in the late 80s, early 90s, I think he could have been, I don't know, say a big star, but he could have been a guy who was on the level of maybe a Z-Man or something like that.
Or even above, like about, you know, he was a good talker on both sides, great worker. It's a little weird that he didn't have any bigger runs than he did as a singles.
Yeah. What do you think about Tom Pritchard, Todd, as a performer?
I don't know if I was as high as on him as you guys might be. I mean, I think he fit well into, and I don't think it's a coincidence that he had his best success as tag teams, because I think he was a very talented wrestler. He was good at putting together matches. I thought he was a little bland overall. His persona never really jumped out at me. I thought that, you know, his best success of his career was, you know, the Heavenly Bodies tag team. I thought it was very effective there, but, you know, you had Jim Cornette as a mouthpiece. You know, you had another, you had a couple guys working with him, but they were, you know, talented wrestlers working with him, and he was able to, you know, focus on having, you know, very good matches. And I think that was sort of his best role and the period where he stood out the most. So, yeah, that's sort of my thoughts on Tom Pritchard in a nutshell.
Yeah, Dr. Tom. He's a guy. Yeah, definitely. He wasn't, I would say, a dynamic performer, but he was a guy that definitely should have gotten better. I mean, gotten better than what he got. You know, eventually he did down the line. You know, we went to WWF as part of the Heavenly Bodies, and of course, one of the Body Donnas as Zip. But yeah, he's a guy who very underrated, in my opinion. But also in Continental this time, you know, Big Sam Barber, Bill Dundee was booking earlier in 1989. Well, Bill Dundee is, you know, back to work with Jarrett. And Robert Fuller has come in as the booker. And Robert Fuller reunites the stud stable in full with Jimmy Golden, Brian Lee, Downtown Bruno, and Sylvia. Biggs, and again, and just, you have the Continental from this area like I do. Talk about the greatness of the stud stable.
Robert Fuller is a guy who for a long time, especially and to some degree at this time, got a bad rap for being a guy who maybe booked too much of TV shows around him and around the stud stable. But, I mean, if you look at who was, like, you know, in Memphis the year before when he was booking and all that, I mean, it's not like there was really anything wrong with that. I mean, yeah, I guess I think the bigger criticism of his and the booker was really be when he was in Georgia.
Well, that was a whole nother story. Yeah, years earlier.
Yeah, but I mean, I've always been a big Robert Fuller fan. I mean, he's just such an underrated promo, you know, worker, and he'd been around for so long too. I mean, him and Jimmy Golden, I think, really deserve a lot of credit for just how much durability and longevity they had as wrestlers, and Robert as a promo. And the stud stable just as a unit was just very fun around this time. I mean, maybe not Brian Lee, but Downtown Bruno was a great fit with them. Now it was
Sylvia was effective as well.
Sylvia was really fun. I mean, Sylvia, who was Robert's wife at the time, she was not, I mean, she wasn't a good pro. I don't know if she ever talked, but she was,
she did,
but not memorably, but she was not,
no. But
she was actually a very good ringside valet.
Yeah, the stud stable is very fun, and a lot of the Memphis stuff is on YouTube, so go check it out. And if you watch it, you basically watch Continental stuff too, because Robert used exactly the same everything when he went to Continental. That's the one criticism I have about Robert Fuller, is that he used almost exactly everything the same way, even the same Brickhouse Brown racial angle.
Now, was it Brickhouse Brown here, or was it someone else?
Yes, okay. Yeah. They had the stud stable victory party in the locker room, and Brickhouse Brown, they gave him watermelon.
Well, it's the same angle, which, because I think Cornette booked it years later in WWF, it's the same basic idea as the Rock getting presents for the Nation of Domination angle, where he ended up getting Farouk the framed portrait of himself.
It's the same. And they eventually brought Cactus Jack in, just like they did in Memphis and all this other stuff. So it's a very fun run. Yeah, I love this. Love me some stud stable.
Didn't you also have Randy Hales in around this time as a heel manager, as Botswana Beast's manager?
That was earlier.
Okay.
Yeah, that was earlier on. That was when Bill Dundee was booking.
Okay. Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. So yeah, Continental, just a fun territory, and they only lasted four more months after this. So before they closed shop, but. Yeah, just one of my all-time favorite groups. Anyway, moving on to the AWA, who this time period was in a real interesting position as they were transforming themselves in promotion. They were doing basically no house shows in a lot of ways.
Nothing that was new,
but they were moving their television to Rochester, Minnesota. They were just trying different things, throwing different things on the wall. Well, they had this grand plan of doing this deal where they would come up with three teams and call it the Team Challenge Series. And you had the what was Sarge's team, Bix?
Sarge's
Team USA
Sniper. No, but it was
Sarge's Snipers.
Sarge's Snipers, Blitzers, and
Baron's
Legends.
And Larry's Legends. So, of course, Baron Von Raschke, Larry Zbyszko, Sergeant Slaughter. Well, Larry Zbyszko was not the original guy to have a team. It was supposed to be Roddy Piper, according to the newsletters in this time period. And his team was going to be called the West Coast Waves, which is a weird name.
Very roller derby.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. it's very roller derby name, because this concept was come up because at this time period, American Gladiators and Roller Games was getting on syndicated television and doing fairly well. So Vern Gagne, ever the evolutionist in wrestling theory, decided to create this series, and they even tried to pitch it to TBS, who owned the wrestling promotion, which was interesting. I don't know if they ever had meetings or not, but that was one of his original plans. But the Team Challenge series, Bix, this thing eventually came off the ground later on, but wow. what a cluster this turned out to be.
Where do we start? I think the two things that it's generally remembered the best for, even though the whole concept was bad, were the tapings, where I believe it was either they couldn't get the Mayo Civic Center for some reason, like their date got canceled, or they shot a taping where the footage became unusable. I think it was the latter, but I'm not sure. They ended up having to tape at a TV studio, but it was like last second and it was too small, or the insurance meant they couldn't have fans. And they had an empty pink studio
The pink studio, yes.
Which they said was for security reasons to prevent outside interference. And they had like one guy in a security guard outfit. So it's that. And then also, I believe the match, which was part of those tapings, which was the Great American Turkey Hunt, where you had to get a frozen turkey off a pole.
Yeah, folks, this is as silly as it sounds. And then you had the teams that were changed so often because guys were leaving. Like, I think Vince was taking guys on purpose just to screw with the Team Challenge series.
With this version of the AWA.
Yeah, to screw with this version of AWA, which gets me to my question to Todd. Is Todd, AWA had such a strong run for many years. And then as the 80s went on, they just went downhill year after year after year. And this time period, they had some pretty good matches on television, but I mean, all hope was lost in the promotion. Do you think that there was any way that Vern Gagne could have turned the tide and like gotten better?
At this point in time, no. I mean, you described this going down year after year after year. I mean, I'd liken it more to like falling off a cliff, crashing at the bottom of the cliff into a million pieces and then lying there at the bottom of a cliff for 5 years. That was the AWA to me. They're sitting here at the bottom of a cliff and barely moving, with the blood pouring out. It was not a good period for the AWA. Although I can sort of relate to the team concept in the sense that, like, this was a period when they were orienting wrestling a lot towards kids. And, at that period of time as a kid, I remember some of my favorite cartoons were a similar premise, where you had like the Laugh Olympics and wacky races.
Oh, I love
basically
those.
The Laugh Olympics of wrestling, yes.
Oh, yeah. Man. But yeah, we had no Muttley, though, in AWA.
No. But wasn't the Laugh Olympics the one where they couldn't have Dick Dastardly and Muttley for some legal reason?
No, they were in it. Dick Dastardly and Muttley were on the Laugh Olympics.
So wait, which was the one that had the ersatz, Dick Dastardly and Muttley?
I can't remember, but Laugh Olympics.
I think it might have been Laugh Olympics.
No, believe me. As a Laugh Olympics historian, look, Dick Dastardly and Muttley were on there because they were in there with the Dirty Daltons and the one that was the fake Adams Family type of setup. They were the Rudo team of the Laugh Olympics. And then you had, of course, you had Scooby and his team, and then Yogi and his team. But yeah, Dick Dastardly and Muttley were definitely on the Laugh Olympics and were the stars of the show. So, but yeah, there were definitely parallels there, no doubt. That's pretty funny. I'm trying to think of who would be the Snagglepuss as the announcer for AWA. I guess Lee Marshall would be Snagglepuss or something like that. And speaking of announcing, Larry Nelson.
Wait a second, I was right. I'm looking it up on TV Tropes. It was... Give me one second. Go on, and I'll find the name of the guys again. Oh, here we go. Hanna-Barbera wanted to use Dick Dastardly and Muttley as captains of the Rottens, but Merrill Heater or someone was still angry. Oh, another company still had part ownership of the Wacky Races characters. So they had a comic book reveal that Dick...
They called him Dread Baron.
Dread Baron.
And Mumbly.
Yes.
And Mumbly. That's right. You are right. But they—I mean—they were the same characters.
They're the same characters. Yes.
But Dread Baron and Mumbly. You're right. You're right. You're right.
I'm so disappointed by the Laugh Olympics historian.
I know, man. God. Well, it's sort of easy to get confused because they were, like I said, the same exact characters.
I mean, it's Hanna-Barbera too, so they're drawn exactly the same.
They're drawn exactly the same. So yeah, that I mean that's yeah, and it's in fact, Dread Baron was revealed as the twin brother of Dick Dastardly.
Yeah,
which is hilarious. I didn't know that until I just now read it. So anyway, and actually, Mumbly had his own show at one point.
He did
the new Tom and Jerry Grape Ape Mumbly show. So good for Mumbly.
By the way, this is like a perfect comparison for the WWF lawsuit when Scott Hall and Kevin Nash went to WCW.
fake Diesel and fake Razor Ramon. Yes. I don't think Glenn Jacobs though was being portrayed as Kevin Nash's twin brother.
Well, I was thinking in terms of like WCW wanting you to believe that they were these other characters, and that's you know that's essentially what the Laugh Olympics was trying to do.
Yeah,
pull a fast one.
Yeah,
and then Eric Bischoff would have to ask Dread Baron and Mumbly if they were sent by the Laugh Olympics.
Exactly.
Sent by
Wacky Races. Yeah.
And what a great segue. Larry Nelson retires, thank God, from AWA, and he's replaced by one Eric Bischoff. Todd, Vern's dead now. You know, rest in peace, Vern. But
he says that for a hearty chuckle.
he brought Eric Bischoff into the wrestling world. I'm trying to think of a way around this without trying to coming off as offensive. But Eric Bischoff, I mean, he did have a.
Are you asking me if Vern Gagne deserved to die for bringing Eric Bischoff into the wrestling?
No, I was thinking that Vern Gagne deserved a place in hell for bringing Eric Bischoff, but I'm trying.
That's actually even worse. I wasn't expecting that.
I was trying to dance. It was in my head, and you forced it out of me.
I thought you were going to go with an Alzheimer's question.
But Eric Bischoff, I mean, yeah, he had a good run, but. One of the most polarizing people in the history of wrestling. And Vern Gagne is the guy that brought him in. Thoughts about Eric Bischoff?
I mean, I'm not as down on Eric Bischoff as I think a lot of people are. I think a lot of people dislike Eric Bischoff for personal reasons because he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way when he was in charge of WCW. I think he made a lot of mistakes that – set up WCW's demise, but there were also a lot of other factors playing, you know, a role in that. I don't have a particularly negative opinion of Eric Bischoff, to be perfectly honest. There are a lot of people that were around that WCW period that I view as having a more harmful long-term effect on what was going on. I don't glorify Eric Bischoff. I think, you know, as I said, I think he did make a lot of mistakes that caused long-term problems. But I think he also had a lot of good ideas that I think helped the promotion. And if anything, I think from people that follow the business very closely, I would say that Eric Bischoff probably gets less credit than he deserves, as opposed to more credit than he deserves.
I would agree with that.
And yeah, I mean, when he had his run, he definitely, you know, did a lot of great things for the business. And on television, especially, you know, once he found his character, I mean, he was really, really good as a character. And that leads me to the question to Biggs. Larry Nelson as a television character, though, was totally different. Talk about Larry Nelson.
Do I have to?
Yes, you do. I'm making you.
I don't think you have to. I feel like you have free choice.
I'm putting a gun to your head.
He was like the last in the line of your AWA style announcers. Only he was
David Crockett. AWA.
He was the David Crockett of the AWA, but he was also like. He still came sort of from the same lineage as Roger Kent and Rod Trongard, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but more over the top. And I don't think I don't think Roger Kent would wear a
the rockers stuff.
Yeah, wearing the rocker stuff like that. But and Eric Bischoff as an announcer, talk about Milk Toast. To see him transform from being Eric Bischoff C-level announcer to Eric Bischoff, lead heel was amazing. So nobody knew he had it in him. So props to him for that.
Well, after the first year of Nitro, you could sort of tell he had it in him.
That's what I'm saying. But yeah, but he worked in WCW though for 4 years before that happened.
Yeah.
And was, well, the boss for 2 years, but still, I mean, yeah, Eric Bischoff, the announcer, like you watch him on Halloween Havoc, dressed as the vampire, or you see him in all this other stuff. And he I wouldn't say Michael Cole type, but that type of announcer, like Michael Cole before, like early Michael Cole.
97, 98 Michael Cole.
Yeah, that was Eric Bischoff. But one real quick thing on AWA is they created this little sister promotion called the American Wrestling Club in Chicago.
I did not know about this until. Was this really just part of Windy City?
It was not. I guess Windy City fell under it, but it was like Johnny Stewart, Tokyo Bullets, a team called the Powerhouse, the Destruction Crew, and Tommy Jammer. All of the young guys from AWA were the main guys, and of course the AWA's top talent would come in every so often, but like it didn't last very long. Which is a little interesting side deal. And last but not least, we're talking about the World Wrestling Federation. And
the worldwide leader in sports.
The worldwide leader in sports entertainment.
The recognized symbol of excellence.
Recognized symbol of excellence, correct. There was an issue the 2 days before this week started, we're recovering, they had a Saturday Night Main Event taping. And I think it was Worcester, Mass. Is that right? The Centrum? Sounds about right. But Hulk Hogan shot a big angle with Zeus. Now, wasn't it Beefcake and Savage? That was the match, right, Biggs?
Hogan and Beefcake against Savage and Zeus at SummerSlam, yeah.
No, that's about the Saturday Night Main Event.
Oh, yes, Beefcake and Savage.
That's right. So Zeus comes in, and gets involved, and Hogan comes
Well, they also did Zeus with Boss Man and Hogan, too.
Yeah. And Hogan suffers a pinched nerve throughout the fracas and has to be taken off house shows until August the 9th. I think, though, there was a problem that they didn't tell the people that he was going to be at some of these shows. It was par for the course back then. So you had a lot of upset fans. That was a pretty shitty business practices, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah.
If you got your biggest guy in the promotion not showing due to an injury, at least offer refunds or put a sign up on the ticket window or something, right? I mean, that's the proper way of doing it.
Right, and then you just do the thing where it's like, but he will be replaced by Rowdy Roddy Piper or whatever.
He was replaced by Beefcake.
Well, that's why then.
That's even worse. So Beefcake was working Savage around the horn, which made sense angle-wise, but yeah, I mean that was
and Leslie was not a bad wrestler at this point.
Well, he was actually getting better.
89-90, he was starting to get much better.
And then, of course, he had the boat crash that basically ended his career.
It wasn't a boat crash. It was he was like on a boat or on the beach, and
parasailing,
and she ran into him.
Yeah, yeah, he was. I don't know. He wasn't water skiing. He was wakeboarding or something.
No. She was parasailing. He wasn't.
No, he was.
No, he was not parasailing. It was that unless they were both parasailing, but there was
He was on the water.
Right. I think he was just on a boat or something. But there was a girl that was parasailing.
No, he was on the back. No, he was in the water. I think either water skiing or something, and she hit him.
Okay.
He wasn't in the boat.
Okay.
No, but either way, he got his face all messed up. And had to set out a few years. But Zeus, Todd, No Holds Barred was a big deal in that time period. It was made a lot of money. And in fact, at this point of the run, yeah, it did, actually, considering. It was in the dollar theaters at this point, doing pretty good. talk about Zeus, Tiny Lister, and I guess could he been used better? Or longer to say, or did he stay the perfect amount of time?
Could he have been used better? It's hard to imagine. Could he have been used longer? Probably. They tried to drag it on for as long as they could. He did have big limitations, obviously, as far as a wrestler. Vince McMahon, for a very long period of time, has been way too focused on physiques. Physiques just don't matter like they used to. And so it's sort of, I think for a lot of us that, you know, watch wrestling over the last 15 years, it's annoying the way Vince is constantly bringing in and pushing these muscle heads who aren't going to get over because they can't talk, they don't have charisma, they're not good wrestlers. And those are what fans are looking for. But Vince's idea of physiques being important isn't something that never mattered. In fact, it was something that mattered a lot at one point in time. And Zeus was really the last great example of Vince McMahon making a lot of money and having a lot of success just based on a guy's physique. You know, he brought this guy in there. He couldn't wrestle. He couldn't perform. But they just treated him like a monster, and he looked really scary standing there. And, you know, he did very limited things. He grabbed Hogan's neck. He twisted his neck. That was about all he did. And SummerSlam was a big success that year. And, you know, they made money later down the line selling the no-holds-barred movie and match gimmick later on pay-per-view as well. I mean, Zeus was a real success story. And, I mean, I think – when Vince is, you know, pushing, you know, the great Khali, or, you know, giving the big push to, you know, whoever it is coming in, I think it's guys like Zeus that he's thinking about as far as what the model is.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, they were on Arsenio on the 21st, him and Sensational Sherry promoting that whole deal. And Arsenio at this time period was intertwined with wrestling in a lot of ways. He had many different wrestlers, all from World Wrestling Federation, Hogan, Warrior, Savage, you know, all those guys coming in. And in fact, he wanted to use some guys from the NWA, but
he was actually a much bigger WCW fan than he was a WWF fan.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense because he was from Cleveland, which was, you know, Georgia Championship Wrestling. Crockett ran a lot in Cleveland. Cleveland was a split city, but there was a lot of, you know, like I said, a lot of shows being run there from Crockett perspective. So, you know, and people don't know how big, I mean, like a lot of people don't know from this era how big Arsenio was in this time period. I mean, think of Arsenio as like Jimmy Fallon's Tonight Show in 1989, basically, as far as like perception from the age group that he's going for. I mean, it was huge. Nobody had done a show like that before, you know, especially, you know, the black talk show host. It was aimed at that type of demographic, a lot of different things, new things going on. And, you know, Carson was, you know, the old stay, you know, constant show. And here comes this new show just, you know, blowing out of the water. And like I said, he was bringing on these wrestlers. And yeah, I mean, it was a big deal for them to be on the show. Zeus. And it, even to this day, whenever Tiny Lister does movies, he's talked about as Zeus.
He's credited a lot of the time as Tiny Zeus Lister.
Exactly. So it's been, you know, over 25 years ago, and he's still using that gimmick. So props to him. Dusty Rhodes, we talked about a while ago, makes his television debut outside of skits on the July 22nd episode of Superstars, where he steals Big Boss Man's nightstick and handcuffs and appears on the Brother Love Show. Todd, Dusty Rhodes as a character in WWF, I mean, those skits leading up to him, they were hilarious. And I know they're supposed to, I guess people would think they were probably demeaning to Dusty, but Dusty, you know, the old saying, make chicken salad out of chicken shit.
He sells.
Buddy, he did it.
What are your opinion of those skits?
I mean, here's the thing. Like, I mean, he definitely made the most of them, and it's a credit to him that he was able to get as much mileage out of his WWF character that he was, because it was very much booked in a way to sort of make fun of him, and he got himself over, which, you know, speaks to his charisma and his personality and all the things that he had going for him over the years. You ask what I thought of the skits. I mean, I'm reluctant to endorse them because they were, you know, they were very much geared towards making fun of them. And I think he did as good of a job as he could of making them entertaining, but I don't think that justifies, you know, taking a guy that is, you know, been one of the biggest stars in the business for 15 years and shooting, you know, an extended vignette about him cleaning a toilet. You know, like I don't want to endorse that, even if I think he made the segment any better than it had a right to be.
Yeah, I mean, it was demeaning. Like
better than any right had to be.
Sorry. Yeah, but you know, as I said, he made it funny. He turned it around and made it work. And it's funny, Bix, that he was programmed with Boss Man when he come in because, you know, Ray Traylor is a guy that would be nowhere without Dusty Rhodes.
Yep.
You know, when he created Big Bubba Rogers. And Boss Man this time was really good as a worker.
Oh, yeah.
So, it was – and Dusty hadn't got the polka dots yet.
No. When did the polka dots start? Like
polka dots started around SummerSlam. Yeah. So he was still black tights. He was wearing the tie dye shirt and the police hat.
Yep.
So that was his deal at this time period. And speaking of the police, we go to Jake the Snake Roberts. Jake had some issues legally for most of 1989. We'll start in 88. We'll talk about in a second, but he was getting harassed at his home, and I guess he was living in Stone Mountain, Georgia at the time, because his address was put in one of the Georgia newspapers. I don't know if it was an Atlanta paper or one of the papers from around the area, little side papers. But, yeah, people were, like, sending him all kinds of mail and just really giving him a hard time. You know, so they found out where he lived. They were going by his house and, you know, I guess knocking on his door or some crap like that. But, yeah, Jake's legal situation was he, in December of 88, after a show in Orlando, he was at a strip club named the Sugar Shack. And he, you know, struck up a conversation with a guy named John Bartlett. And they were drinking together and stuff like that. And they eventually left together. I don't know where they were going. This is 4 a.m. But they on the road, they got into an argument about Daytona Beach women and people at Daytona Beach in general. And Jake, you know, started ripping on them. Well, Barlow, who's an ex-Marine, started yelling back at him. And Jake eventually stopped the car and just beat the shit out of the guy. He broke his orbital bone in his eye. And the guy had to have surgery to, you know, correct his, you know, issues, and there was a warrant out for Jake's arrest. Well, of course, you know, he's not going to Orlando until the next show. Well, I guess he forgot about it or whatever, but he went and worked the next show, which was in May. And when he was there, they arrested him in the building and took him to jail. And he stayed in jail for a little bit, posted bail. But, Bix, this is, we have issues in this time period where guys had stuff going on in areas and they wouldn't go to, like Stan Lane couldn't wrestle in Florida for some odd reasons. And there were guys, you know, of course, that couldn't get into Canada because of drug issues in the past. It still happens now, but you would have thought that Jake would have been a little bit smarter and said, hey, I can't go to Orlando, right?
You would think so, but who knows what was going through his head.
Well, yeah, it's Jake Roberts. I'm sure going through his head this time period was a lot of alcohol and drug use, sadly, you know. And he was convicted on July 5th, and like I said, he eventually got out on bail. And it took 2 years after the fact for him to get his conviction overturned. And Todd, I know you're a lawman. 2 years. Is that considered like a long distance of time for a conviction to be overturned, or is that like a par for the course for appeals, or how does that go?
Well, especially for someone who was not serving time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's unusual. I mean, it's going to vary depending upon the state and sort of the appeals process. But yeah, that's not to be expected, particularly with something that's sort of a minor offense. But Jake had, you know, more resources than a lot of people are going to have, which, you know, plays to his benefit. And I mean, this was a common thing in the 80s with pro wrestlers. You know, it feels like, you know, a lot of wrestlers during that time period were getting charged with this or that. It was, you know, still very much an outlaw business. And there's sort of the, you know, the joke now about the guys going back to their, you know, hotel rooms and playing video games, and people, you know, sort of make fun of it as far as sort of the minimization of the out of the ring debauchery that goes on with, you know, any occupation that has a bunch of, you know, young guys with a lot of money, and, you know, it sort of leads itself to excesses. But I think, you know, by and large, the wrestlers of today are, you know, a lot better behaved than the wrestlers of previous generations, as far as avoiding getting into fights and confrontations and various legal troubles.
Okay, here's the deal.
Yeah, I'm looking at the article about the appeal.
All right, here's the deal. Yeah, Nanako Council. Yeah, but here you go. All right, among other things, Roberts claimed that Tampa attorney Robert Boland apologized for objecting to evidence, although he shouldn't have apologized, and he had to be roused from his motel room the morning of the trial. In a blistering dissent, Judge Joe A. Cowart Jr. warned that handing out new trials to defendants who claimed they had lousy lawyers could open the gate to a road that has no end. As long as a lawyer is considered sufficiently competent to practice law and a defendant has an understood right to select his lawyer, the defendant should bear the risk. And it was that the bar owner said, James Miller, he said, "It's not your typical commercial transaction. A person's personal freedom may be at stake. If a person is found guilty of a crime because they committed a crime, it's one thing. If somebody's found guilty because of an incompetent lawyer, that's another." So, yeah.
No, but that's even more unusual. I wouldn't have figured that would have been the circumstances of it, both because I figured he would have been able to hire a good attorney from the beginning, but also because, as you alluded to in the dissent, it's very difficult to get convictions overturned because of inadequate assistance of counsel. I mean, you know, I've seen cases where, you know, attorneys were just acting unspeakably terrible, you know, falling asleep, you know, just making, you know, terrible mistakes, and courts still refusing to overturn previous convictions. So I don't know. I mean, it's possible that, you know, Jake might have been able to get something of preferential treatment because of his status. I mean, that's just speculation on my part, but it's unusual to see that. And I am kind of surprised that those are sort of the facts of what happened.
All right, and then you have like the jury, you know, went to a jury trial, and Bartlett is 5'7", weighing 160, and Jake, of course, is 6'4", 230, 240. So that's not a good look for Jake, you know, being that much bigger. All right, you know, and 8 days later, Roberts asked for a new trial, though it was he who had hired Robert Boland. Circuit Judge Gail Graziano conceded that Boland performed dismally during the trial, but denied Roberts' motion. So, and it said that Jake, at one point during the case and testimony, made a tearful plea for mercy, saying that violence in pro wrestling is staged and that he was more of a thespian than a fighter. Interesting. But, yeah, I mean, that's just...
We think Jake actually used the word thespian, or do we think that's the...
That's what it says! But, yeah, I mean, that's just crazy, man, that, you know, and like I said, I'm sure you've seen it, where lawyers are so bad that it can affect a case, you know, the wrong way, where somebody that does something bad can get off because of bad lawyer.
Yeah, and again, it's difficult to get something overturned. I mean, as you just, you know, you mentioned there, the judge ruling that, yeah, this was, you know, this was apparently terrible work by Jake's attorney, but I'm still not going to overturn this. I mean, that's, you know, that would, you know, that's the much more common response to that sort of thing. But hey, you know, good for good for Jake. He managed to avoid trouble for once.
Yeah, and he was sentenced to perform 100 hours of community service and pay all his medical bills. So he had to do all that. He was on 10 years probation originally and fined $10,000. So I guess his probation got revoked. But wow. It's great. And Jake, you know, had a lot of issues after that fact. But wow, that's a crazy, crazy situation. But on that note, we are going to end this show. It's time to get the plugs in. Todd, what exciting things you have going on with the Torch right now?
Recording an audio show every week with Wade Keller and doing all sorts of other stuff with the Torch site. I've been really pleased with both the content that we've put forward thus far and the reception to it. When I joined the Torch, with these things, you're never sure what sort of chemistry you're going to have with people before you join on. But I think that the shows with Wade have been terrific. I think people that haven't tried it out, if they do try it out, will really enjoy it. There's actually a sale that's been going on. I don't know if it'll still be going on at the time people listen to this, but it very well may. If you go to the Torch, where you can get a sample essentially of a month's content for something like $1. And try it out, see what you think for yourself. I think there's a lot of terrific stuff there. I'm really pleased with the response, and I encourage people to check it out. So, yeah, pwtorch.com is the place to go there.
Awesome. And, yeah, Bruce Mitchell is one of my favorites. So, yeah, definitely go check out the Torch for his stuff. Wade's always good.
There's a Todd there. Has he radio shows?
Yeah, there's a lot of great archive content on there, too. Ton of good stuff on that site. Bix, I know you have about a million things that you're involved in. So what's the most important things you got going on right now?
Let's see. WrestlingInc.com. I've got the Wrestling Inc. podcast after every Raw, every pay-per-view, and some breaking news. Every WWE pay-per-view. That's me and Sean Ross Sapp. Plus I do Today in Wrestling History there, plus some other stuff. WrestlingObserver.com, do the Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday daily updates, do Figure Four Weekly, usually goes up on Fridays, sometimes Saturdays. Fighting Spirit Magazine, usually got something each month. The new issue, I believe, is a week from Thursday. Actually, wait, it's either this Thursday or a week from Thursday. I think it's a week from Thursday is the new issue. And I got a couple things in that, including an article about the anniversary of First Monday Nitro.
Wow, 20 years coming up.
Yeah, it makes me feel old.
My God.
Let's see, is there anything else? I mean, you know, I'm going to try to get a new show. I have some stuff recorded up just on my podcast, davidbix.com. And if you buy anything from luchashop.com, use the coupon code BIX for 10% off.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And I have some other stuff. I have some other new stuff that'll come out soon that you'll hear about, but that's it for now.
Yeah, if you follow Bix on Twitter.
Yes, and of course, follow me on Twitter at David Bix.
At David Bix, you'll find all that stuff. At Todd Martin MMA for Todd. At Chris Zellner for me, KrisZellner. And this show will be dropping every Monday. We're doing it every week. So every Monday, you'll be able to hear us pontificate on this type of stuff.
Have you confirmed our guest for next week yet?
I have not. So I'm not going to make an announcement yet. In fact, the guest I'm talking to was currently at a – well, I don't know if he's still at a show, but he was at a wrestling show tonight. So okay. We'll see whenever he gets back with me. But new episode of Exile on Bad Street should be up. Say this goes up Monday, tomorrow, then that means the Exile on Bad Street may come up tomorrow as well or maybe Tuesday. So be on the lookout for that one. If you love Memphis, you'll love this show. But it's going to be Memphis heavy. It's the first one I've done with Memphis. So be on the lookout for that. And, of course, find all the other Exile and Bash Street shows on the Place to Be Nation. Searching my name. And you'll get all that goodness. But on that note, for Todd and for Bix, this is Chris. And we're saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.